Wild Cards 3, Joker's Wild, edited by George R. R. Martin, and written by Melinda M. Snodgrass, Leanne C. Harper, Walton Simons, Lewis Shiner, John J. Miller, George R. R. Martin, and Edward Bryant. Read for you by Felicia Day, Ron Donahue, Pam Greer, Stephen McCaddy, Prentice Anayemi, Ray Porter, and Molly Quinn.
Prologue. There is Mardi Gras in New Orleans, Carnival in Rio, fiestas and festivals and Founders' Days by the hundreds. The Irish have St. Patrick's Day, the Italians Columbus Day, the nation its 4th of July. History is full of mummers' parades and masks and orgies and religious pageants and patriotic extravaganzas. Wildcard Day has a little of all of that, and more. On September 15, 1946, in the cold afternoon sky over Manhattan, Jet Boy died and the Takesian xenovirus, known colloquially as the Wild Card, was loosed upon the world. It is unclear just when the observances began, but by the late 60s, those who had felt the touch of the Wild Card and had lived to talk of it, the Jokers and Aces of New York City, had taken the day as their own. September 15th became Wild Card Day, a time for celebrations and lamentations, for grief and joy, for remembering the dead and cherishing the living. A day for fireworks and street fairs and parades, for masked balls and political rallies and memorial banquets, for drinking and making love and fighting in the alleys. With each passing year, the festivities became larger and more fevered. Taverns and restaurants and hospitals did record-setting business. The media began to notice. And finally, of course, the tourists arrived. Once a year, without sanction or statute, Wild Card Day engulfed Jokertown and New York City, and the carnival of chaos ruled the streets. September 15th, 1986, was the 40th anniversary.
Chapter 1, 6 a.m. It was as dark as it ever gets on Fifth Avenue, and as quiet. Jennifer Malloy glanced at the street lights and the steady stream of traffic and pursed her lips in annoyance. She didn't like all the light and activity, but there wasn't much she could do about it. This was, after all, Fifth Avenue and 73rd Street in the city that never sleeps. It had been equally as busy the past few mornings she'd spent checking out the area, and she had no reason to expect that conditions would ever get any better. Hands thrust deep into the pockets of her trench coat, she strode past the 5-story graystone apartment building and slipped into the alley behind it. Here was darkness and silence. She stepped into an area of the alley that was screened by a garbage dumpster and smiled. No matter how many times she'd done this, she thought, it was still exciting. Her pulse speeded up, and she breathed faster in anticipation, as she put on a hood-like mask that obscured her finely sculpted features and hid the mass of blonde hair tied in a knot at the back of her head. She took off her trench coat, folded it neatly, and set it down next to the dumpster. Under the coat, she wore only a brief black string bikini and running shoes. Her body was lean and gracefully muscular, with small breasts, slim hips, and long legs. She bent down, unlaced and removed her sneakers, and put them next to the trench coat. She ran a hand almost caressingly over the rear wall of the graystone apartment building, smiled, and then walked right through the wall.
It was the sound of a power saw biting into sodden hardwood. The whine of steel teeth made Jack's own teeth ache as the all-too-familiar boy struggled to hide deeper within the cypress tangle.
"He in there somewhere!"
It was his Uncle Jacques. The folks around Atelier Parish called him Snake Jake, behind his back. The boy bit his lip to keep from crying out. He bit deeper, tasting blood, to keep from changing. Sometimes that worked. Sometimes. Again, the steel saw shrieked into wet cypress. The boy ducked down low, brown, brackish water slopped against his mouth, into his nose. He choked as the bayou washed over his face.
"Told you! That little gator bait right there. Get him!"
Other voices joined in, The power saw blade whined one more time. Jack Robichaux flailed out in the darkness, one arm trapped in the sweaty sheet, the other reaching for the phone. He slammed the Tiffany lamp back against the wall, cursed as he somehow caught its petals and stems base and steadied it on the bed table, then felt the cool smoothness of the telephone. He picked up the receiver in the middle of the fourth ring. Jack started to curse again. Who the hell had this number? There was Vagabond, but she was in another room here in his home. Before he could get his lips to the mouthpiece, he knew.
"Jack,"
said a voice on the other end of the line. Long-distance static washed out the sound for a second.
"Jack, this is Elouette. I'm calling you from Louisiana."
He smiled in the darkness. "Figured you were." He snapped the lamp switch, but nothing happened. The filament must have broken when the lamp toppled.
"Never actually called this far before," said Elouette. "Robert always dialed."
Robert was her husband.
"What time is it?" Jack said.
He felt for his watch.
"About 5 in the morning,
said his sister.
"What is it? Is it Ma?"
He was waking up finally, pulling free from the fragments of the dream.
"No, Jack. Ma's fine. Nothing'll ever happen to her. She'll outlive us both."
"Then what?"
He recognized the sharpness in his voice and tried to tone it down. It was just that Elouette's words were so slow, her thoughts so drawn out. The silence, punctuated by bursts of static, dilated on the line. Finally, Elouette said,
"It's my daughter."
"Cordelia? What about her? What's wrong?"
Another silence.
"She's run off."
Jack felt an odd reaction. After all, he'd run away, too, all those years before. Run away when he was a hell of a lot younger than Cordelia. What would she be now? 15? 16?
"Tell me what happened,"
he said reassuringly. Elouette did. Cordelia, she said, had given little warning. The girl had not come down for breakfast the morning before. Makeup, clothing, money, and an overnight bag were also gone. Her father had checked with Cordelia's friends. There weren't many. He called the parish sheriff. The patrols got the word. No one had seen her. The law's best guess was that Cordelia had hitched a ride out on the blacktop. The sheriff had shaken his head sadly.
"Gal look like that?"
he'd said.
"Well, we got cause to worry."
He'd done what he could, but it had all taken precious time. It had finally been Cordelia's father who'd come up with something. A girl with the same face.
"Prettiest little thing I seen in a month,"
the ticket clerk had said, and long, luxuriant black hair.
"Black as a new moon bayou sky,"
said a porter, had boarded a bus in Baton Rouge.
"It was Greyhound,"
Elouette said.
"One way fare to New York City. By the time we found out, the police said it wasn't none too practical to try and stop it in New Jersey."
Her voice shook slightly, as though she wanted to cry.
"It'll be okay,"
said Jack.
"When is she supposed to get here?"
"About 7,
Elouette said.
7 your time."
"Merde."
Jack swung his legs off the bed and sat up in the darkness.
"Can you get there, Jack? Can you find her?"
"Sure," he said. "But I gotta leave now for Port Authority, or I won't make it in time."
"Thanks, B,"
Elouette said.
"Call me after you've met her?"
"I will. Then we'll figure out what to do next. Now I go, okay?"
"Okay. I'll be right here. Maybe Robert will be back, too."
Trust filled her voice.
"Thanks, Jack."
He put down the phone and stumbled across the room. He found the wall switch and finally was able to see in the windowless room. Yesterday's work clothes were strewn over the rough slab bench to one side. Jack pulled on the well-worn jeans and green cotton shirt. He grimaced at the fragrant work socks, but they were all he had. Today being his day off, he'd planned to spend it at a laundromat. He laced the steel-toed leather boots quickly, catching every other pair of eyelets. When he opened the door leading into the rest of his home, Vagabond, the two huge cats, a passel of kittens, and a goggle-faced raccoon were all there in the doorway, silently staring at him. In the dimness of the lamp-lit living room beyond, Jack made out the gleam of Vagabond's dark brown hair and even darker eyes, her high, shadowed cheekbones, the lightness of her skin.
"Jesus, Mother Mary," he said, stepping back. "Don't scare me like that."
He took a deep breath and felt the tough, grainy hide on the back of his hands become soft again.
"Didn't mean to,"
said Vagabond. The black cat rubbed up against Jack's leg. His back nestled along the man's kneecap. His purr sounded like a contented coffee grinder.
"Heard the phone. You okay?"
"I'll tell you on the way to the door."
He gave Vagabond a précis as he stepped in the kitchen to decant the last of yesterday's coffee sludge into a foam cup he could carry with him. Vagabond touched his wrist.
"When is to come along? Day like this, a few more eyes might be valuable at the bus station."
Jack shook his head.
"Shouldn't be any problem. She's 16 and never been in any big city before. Just watched a lot of TV, her mama says. I'll be right there at the bus door to meet her."
"She know that?"
said Vagabond. Jack stooped to give the black a quick rub behind the ears. The calico meowed and moved over to take her turn.
"Nope. Probably she was going to phone me once she got here. This'll just save time."
"Office still open?"
"I'll have her back here for breakfast before you know it."
Jack paused.
"Maybe not. She want to talk, so maybe I take her to the automat. She won't have seen anything like that back in Atelier."
He straightened up and the cats yowled disappointedly.
"Besides, you got an appointment with Rosemary, right?"
Vagabond nodded dubiously.
9.
"Just don't worry. Maybe we can all have lunch. Depends on how much of a zoo downtown turns into. Maybe we can pick up takeout at a Korean deli and have a picnic on the Staten Island ferry."
He leaned toward the woman and gave her a quick kiss on the forehead. Before she could even halfway raise her hands to grasp his arms and reciprocate, he was gone, out the door, out of her perception.
"Damn it,"
she said. The cats looked up at her, confused but sympathetic. The raccoon hugged her ankle.
Jennifer Malloy slipped through the lower two floors of the apartment building like a ghost, disturbing nothing and no one, neither seen nor heard. She knew that the building had gone condo some time ago, and what she wanted was on the uppermost of the three floors that were owned by a rich businessman with the unfortunate name of Kien Phuc. He was Vietnamese. He owned a string of restaurants and dry cleaning establishments. At least, that's what they'd said on the segment of New York Style she'd seen on PBS 2 weeks ago. Jennifer really enjoyed that show, which took its viewers on tours of the artsy and stylish homes of the city's upper class. It presented her with endless possibilities and tons of useful information. She floated through the third floor, where Kian's servants lived. She had no idea what was on the fourth floor, since it had been ignored by the television cameras, so she bypassed it and headed for Kian's living quarters on the top floor. He lived there alone in 8 rooms of unrelieved luxury and opulence, decadence almost. Jennifer had never realized there was that much money in laundromats and Chinese restaurants. It was dark on the fifth floor and quiet. She avoided the bedroom with the circular mirror-ceilinged bed. A little tacky, she thought when she'd seen it on TV, and the fabulous hand-painted silk screens. She bypassed the Western-style sitting room with its 2,000-year-old bronze Buddha gazing benignly from a place of honor next to the fabulous electronic entertainment center, complete with a widescreen television, VCR, and compact disc player with accompanying racks of video and audio tapes and discs. She wanted the study. It was as dark there as it was on the rest of the floor, and she started when she saw a vague, shadowy figure looming beside the huge teakwood desk that dominated the room's back wall. Although impervious to physical attack while ghosting, she wasn't immune to surprise, and this figure hadn't been filmed by the New York-style cameras. She quickly faded into a nearby wall, but the figure didn't move or even show any sign that it had noticed her. She cautiously slipped into the study again and was relieved and astonished to see that the thing was a large, nearly 6-foot-tall terracotta figure of an Oriental warrior. The workmanship of the piece was breathtaking. Facial features, clothing, weaponry, all were molded with exquisite delicacy of detail. It was as if a living man had been turned to clay, baked to a flawless finish in a kiln, and preserved down through the millennia, ending up in Kian's study. Her respect for Kian's wealth and influence went up another notch. The figure was undoubtedly authentic. Kian had made it clear during the television interview that he had no truck with imitations, and from what she knew, the 2,200-year-old terracotta grave figures of the Emperor Ying Zheng, first emperor of the Qin Dynasty and unifier of China, were absolutely, positively unavailable to private art collectors. Kian must have gone through considerable feats of legerdemain and bribery to obtain it. It was a fantastically valuable piece, but, Jennifer knew, too large for her to remove and probably too unique for her defense. She felt a sudden wave of dizziness ripple through her insubstantial form and quickly willed herself to solidity. She didn't like that feeling. It happened whenever she overextended herself, as a warning that she had stayed insubstantial for too long. She didn't know what would happen if she remained a wraith for too long. She never wanted to find out. Now substantial, she looked around the room. It was lined with display cases containing Kian's collection of jades, the most beautiful, extensive, and valuable collection in the Western world. Kian had been profiled on New York Style because of them, and they were what she had come for. Some of them, at least. She realized that she couldn't get them all, even if she made a dozen trips back to the alley, because her ability to turn extraneous mass insubstantial was limited. She could only ghost a few jades at a time, but a few, really, were all she needed. First, though, before starting on the jades, there was something else she had to do. The thick pile of the luxurious carpet feeling quite sensuous on the soles of her bare feet, she glided around the teakwood desk almost as quietly as if she were insubstantial, and stood before the Hakusai print hanging on the wall behind it. Behind the print, so Kian had said, was a wall safe. He had mentioned it because, he had said, it was absolutely 100% totally and irrevocably burglar-proof. No thief knew enough about microcircuitry to circumvent its electronic lock, and it was strong enough to withstand a physical assault short of a bomb big enough to bring down the whole building. No one, no how, at no time, could possibly break into it. Kian, who had looked very smug as he'd said all this, evidently was a man who liked to brag. A mischievous smile on her face as she wondered what riches Kian had hidden in his high-tech safe, Jennifer ghosted her right arm and put her hand through the print and the steel door behind it.
He juggled her in his arms while he fished for his key and finally unlocked the door. "You idiot, put me down. Then you can open the door." "Nope, going to carry you over." "We haven't gotten married." "Yet," he said, and grinned down into her face. Her angle from where she reclined in his arms intensified the deformity of his neck and made his head look like a baseball perched on a pedestal. Aside from that neck, a legacy of the wild card virus. He was a rather handsome man. Short-cropped brown hair, beginning to gray at the temples, merry brown eyes, strong chin, a nice face. He negotiated the door and set her on her feet. "My castle. Hope you like it." It proclaimed the blue-collar origins of this man. Serviceable couch, recliner placed before the television, a stack of Reader's Digest on the coffee table. A large and poorly executed oil painting of a sailing ship clawing through improbably high seas. The sort of painting one found at starving artist sales in Hilton hotels. But it was scrupulously clean, and in a touch that seemed out of character in so large and powerful a man. A row of multicolored African violets lined the window sills. "Roulette. I haven't stayed out all night since my high school prom." "I'll just bet you stayed out all night." He blushed. Hey, I was a good Catholic boy. My mama always warned me about good Catholic boys. He moved in, wrapped brawny arms about her waist. I'm not quite so good anymore. I hope that refers to your morals and not to your performance, Stan. Roulette! Prude, she teased. He nuzzled her neck and nibbled on her earlobe, and Roulette pondered yet again the random nature of Wild Card, that it should have struck this very ordinary sand hog and made him more than human. She reached up and stroked her hands down the sides of his swollen throat. Does it ever bother you? Being the howler? Hell no. Makes me special. And I always wanted to be special. Used to drive my old man crazy. He always said water was good enough for our kind of people, meaning not to get above myself. He'd sure be surprised now. Hey. He reached out, caught a tear on the tip of one thick finger. What are you crying about? Nothing. I found that sad. Well, come on. I'll show you how good my performance can be. Before breakfast, she asked, trying to delay the inevitable. Sure, give us a better appetite. She followed him resignedly into the bedroom.
Jennifer felt around inside the safe and touched something that felt like a stack of coins nestled in a small pouch. She tried to ghost one of the coins and frowned when it remained solid. Probably gold, she thought, Krugerrands or Canadian maple leaves. It was difficult to ghost dense materials like metal, particularly gold, requiring a deeper level of concentration and a greater input of energy. She decided to leave the coins where they were for now and continue to explore the safe. Her hand caressed a flat rectangular object that ghosted a lot easier than the coin. She drew three small notebooks from the wall and, unable to see details in the darkness, switched on a small tensor lamp that sat on the top of the teakwood desk. Two of the books, she could now see, had plain black covers. The third had a blue cloth cover with a bamboo pattern. She flipped open the top book in the stack. Squares of brightly colored bits of paper were stuck in rows of pockets on the notebook's thick pages. Postage stamps. The ones in the top row seemed to be British, but they had words in another language and the date 1922 overprinted on them. She bent down closer to examine them and froze as a tiny sound came from somewhere outside the cone of light illuminating part of the desktop. She glanced up and saw nothing. Her eyes, now accustomed to the light, she tilted the shade of the lamp outward, throwing illumination over the far reaches of the desk. And she froze, her heart suddenly in her throat. On the far corner of the desk was a 5-gallon jar, about the size of a water cooler jug. Only this jar was glass, not plastic, and it wasn't connected to anything. It stood on a flat base on the edge of the desk, home to the thing that floated in it. It was little more than a foot high, with green, glabrous, somewhat warty skin. It floated with its head clear of the water, its web-fingered hands pressed against the glass, its human eyes staring at Jennifer out of a pinched face. They looked at one another for a long moment, and then it opened its mouth and cried out in a high-pitched, wailing voice,
"Kian! Thief! Thief!"
New York Style had said nothing about Kian having a Batrachian Joker watchdog. Jennifer thought giddily as lights snapped on in other rooms. She heard sounds of commotion in other parts of the condo, and the Joker in the glass jar continued to scream for Kian in a ululating voice that seemed to bypass her ears and pierce directly into her brain. "Concentrate," she told herself. "Concentrate, or the daring sneak thief, the self-proclaimed Wraith, will be captured and exposed as Jennifer Malloy, reference librarian at the New York Public Library. She'd lose her job and go to jail for sure. What would her mother think?" There was motion at the door, and someone flicked on the study's overhead light. Jennifer saw a tall, slim, reptilian-looking Joker. He hissed at her, his long, forked tongue lolling out an impossible length. He raised a pistol and fired. His aim was accurate, but the bullet ricocheted harmlessly off the wall, Jennifer was rapidly sinking through the floor, the three notebooks clutched tightly against her chest.
With Jack gone, Vagabond entered her morning ritual still wearing the tiger-striped robe he had given her. Sitting back in one of the red velvet overstuffed chairs, she closed her eyes and pinpointed the creatures who shared her life. The calico cat fed her young kittens as the black cat guarded them. The raccoon slept with his head against her ankles. He was tired from a night of prowling around Jack's Victorian lodgings. Vagabond hoped he had not disturbed anything important. She had set guards in the raccoon's head, warning him off Jack's belongings. Lately, they had proven quite effective, but she never forgot the fight she had had with Jack when the raccoon had removed every one of his pogo books from their shelf. Reaching to stroke the raccoon, she expanded her consciousness out into the city. It was easy now, a waking ritual, although more and more when she wasn't around Jack, Vagabond kept a nocturnal schedule. For years she had maintained their relationship as a casual one, showing up only when the weather was extremely bad, or on days like this, when strangers found their way into places where they normally were too timid to venture. If Jack was home, she stayed. If he was gone, she moved on to another burrow. Lately, though, she had begun to seek his company more often, finding excuses to visit. Jack and Rosemary had both become very important to her, in ways she was not always able to define. It had taken years to trust them, but once she granted that trust, it was frighteningly easy to depend on them to be there for her. She shook her head angrily, unhappy to be distracted into thinking about things that were not under her control, and losing track of the creatures which were. Waking and hunting with her creatures seemed more natural now. Her mind moved among the rats in the tunnels, the moles, rabbits, opossums, squirrels, pigeons, and other birds. She took the night's death toll. There were always many who did not survive. She had learned that there could be no escape for the victims. Many died to feed the predatory animals. Others were killed by men. Once she had tried to save them, to protect the prey from the predators. It had nearly driven her insane again. The natural cycle of life, death, and birth was stronger than she, and so Vagabond had begun to work within it. The animals died. There were more to take their places. Only human interference could upset the rhythm. She couldn't control humans yet. Briefly, she touched the inhabitants of the zoo. Hate for the cages colored her impression. Someday, she promised the zoo prisoners again. Someday. A warm paw on her cheek brought her back. The black cat, all 40 pounds of him, lay across her chest. When her eyes opened, he licked her nose. She reached up and scratched him behind his ear. There was a touch of gray on his muzzle now, but he still moved like a younger cat most days. She sent him the warm feeling she thought of as love. He purred and sent her the image of the calico keeping the kittens away from Jack's Victorian furniture. If not closely watched, the kittens found the lion's paw legs, wonderful scratching posts. "Well, old friend, Jack turned me down again last night. What do you think is wrong?" The subvocalized question received only a querying look from the cat at first, but then he sent the image of 100 of Vagabond's creatures around her. "Yes, I know you're all there, but every once in a while I want another human." She created the image of the black and the calico together as mates. The black returned a vision of Vagabond and a human-sized cat. Vagabond nodded as she looked over at the kittens at play. "Not my type, unfortunately." She wondered why Jack refused to sleep with her. Her frustration and lack of understanding were beginning to turn to anger. It had only begun the last year. Each time she played with the kittens, she felt a lack in her own life. The feeling angered her, but she couldn't deny it. Recently, she had turned to Jack for comfort, but for once, he had turned her away. She resolved not to ask again. Without the layers of dirt and ancient clothing that protected her in the world outside, she knew she was not unattractive. To spare her other friend Rosemary embarrassment, she had learned to dress on rare occasions in an acceptable fashion. It never felt right, though. Those were the times she was really in costume, and she hated them. Perhaps she had become too involved with Jack and Rosemary. Perhaps it was time to go underground again. The Black followed the tone of her thoughts, even if he could not translate their abstract meanings. He added his approval of their severing the relationship with the humans by sending an image of some of their former lairs. But not today. Today I have to go over to see Rosemary. Vagabond pulled herself up out of the chair and walked over to piles of old, dirty, and shapeless clothing, which provided most of her wardrobe. The Black Cat and two kittens followed. No, you're staying here. Jack may want to reach me. Besides, it is hard enough for me to get into her office without you along. She shifted her attention. Blue coat or green army jacket?
There were 13 black candles in the room. When they burned, the wax turned the color of fresh blood and ran down the sides. Now the room was turning gray, and their narrow circles of light were starting to fade.
Do you know what time it is?
Fortunato looked up. Veronica stood next to him in pink cotton panties and a ripped t-shirt, arms crossed over her breasts. Almost dawn, he said.
Are you coming to bed?
She turned her head sideways and waves of black hair fell across her face. Maybe later. Don't stand like that. It makes your stomach stick out.
Yes, oh, sensei.
The sarcasm was muted, childish. A few seconds later, he heard the bathroom door lock. If she wasn't Miranda's daughter, he thought, he would have put her back on the street weeks ago. He stretched, stared for a few seconds at the murky clouds taking shape in the eastern sky. Then he went back to the work in front of him. He'd covered the five-pointed star on his floor with tatami, and on them he'd laid the Mirror of Hathor. It was about a foot long, with an image of the goddess where the handle met the solar disk. Her cow horns made her look a little like a medieval jester. It was made of brass, the front reflective for clairvoyance, the back abraded to rebound an enemy's attacks. He'd ordered it from an aging hippie in the East Village, and had spent the last 2 days purifying it with rituals for all 9 major deities. For months he'd been increasingly unable to think of anything but his enemy, the one who called himself the Astronomer, who'd commanded a vast network of Egyptian masons until Fortunato and the others had destroyed the nest he'd made at the cloisters. The Astronomer had escaped, even if the evil thing he'd brought from space hadn't. The months of silence had only made Fortunato more and more afraid. The Bornless Ritual, the acrostics of Abramelin, the spheres of the Kabbalah, all of Western magic had let him down. He had to use the Astronomer's own magic against him. Had to find him somehow, despite the blocks he'd set up that made him invisible to Fortunato. The trick to Egyptian magic, the real thing, not the Astronomer's warped and bloody version, was to go at it from their reverence for animals. Fortunato had spent his entire life in Manhattan, Harlem at first, then downtown once he could afford it. To him, animals were poodles that left their shit on the sidewalk, or listless, foul-smelling caricatures that slept their lives away at the zoo. He'd never liked or understood them. It was an attitude he could no longer afford. He'd let Veronica bring her cat to the apartment, a vain, overweight, gray tabby named Liz, in honor of the movie star. At the moment, the cat was asleep on his crossed legs, her claws hooked into the silk of his robe. The cat's primitive value system was a doorway into the Egyptian universe. He picked up the mirror. He just about had the mindset. He watched his reflection, lean face, brown skin, a little blotchy from lack of sleep, forehead swollen with rasa, the tantric power of retained sperm. Slowly, his features began to melt and run. He heard a sound from the bathroom, a muffled sigh, and his concentration broke. And then, instead of the Astronomer, he was looking into the mirror and seeing Veronica. She sat on the toilet, her panties around her ankles. In her left hand was a pocket mirror, in her right, a short piece of red-striped soda straw. Her head rolled loosely on her neck, and she rubbed her cheek against her shoulder. He put the mirror of Hawthor back on the mat. The junk didn't surprise him. It was just that she would do it here, right here in his apartment. He moved the protesting cat off his lap and went to the bathroom. He popped the lock with his mind and kicked the door open, and Veronica's head jerked up guiltily.
Hey,
she said. Pack your shit and get out, Fortunato said.
Hey, it's just a little coke, man.
For Christ's sake, how stupid do you think I am? Do you think I don't know smack when I see it? How long you been on this shit? She shrugged, dropped the mirror and straw into her open purse. She stood up, nearly tripped, then saw her feet tangled in her panties. She balanced herself on the towel rack while she pulled them up and snapped the purse closed.
Couple months, she said. But I'm not on anything. I just do it sometimes. Excuse me.
Fortunato let her by.
What the hell is the matter with you? Don't you care what you're doing to yourself?
Care? I'm a fucking hooker. Why should I care? You're not a hooker, goddammit. You're a geisha. He followed her into the bedroom. You've got brains and class and...
Geisha my ass, she said, sitting heavily on the end of the bed. I fuck men for money. That's the goddamn bottom line.
She pushed her unresisting leg into her pantyhose, the big toenail laddering a run all the way down the right side.
You like to kid yourself with all this geisha shit, but real geishas don't fuck for money. You're a pimp, and I'm a whore, and that's all there is to it.
Before Fortunato could say anything, somebody started hammering at the front door. Lines of tension and urgency radiated from the hallway, but nothing threatening. Nothing that couldn't wait.
I don't put up with junkies, he said.
You don't? Don't make me laugh. Half the girls in your stable take at least a snort now and then. 5 or 6 are on the needle. Big time.
Who?
Is Caroline?
No, your precious Caroline is straight. Not that you'd know if she wasn't. You don't know what the fuck is going on.
I don't believe you. I can't... There was a scraping sound in the front room, and the door came open. A man named Brennan stood in the doorway, a strip of plastic in one hand. In the other was a slightly oversized leather attaché case. In it, Fortunato knew, was a disassembled hunting bow and a rack of broadhead arrows.
Fortunato, he said. Sorry, but I...
His eyes moved to Veronica, who had peeled off her t-shirt and was holding her breasts in her hands.
Hi,
she said.
Wanna fuck me? All it takes is money.
She teased her nipples with her thumbs and licked her lips.
How much you got? $2? Buck and a half?
Tears ran out of her eyes, and a line of mucus leaked out of one nostril.
Shut up, Fortunato said. Shut the fuck up.
Why don't you slap me around, she said.
That's what a pimp's supposed to do, isn't it?
Fortunato looked back at Brennan.
Maybe you should come back later, he said. I don't know if it can wait, Brennan said. It's the astronomer.
Chapter 2. 7 a.m. By the time he got to the Port Authority bus terminal, Jack wished he had taken his electric track maintenance car and sped uptown playing hopscotch with the trains. But what the hell, he'd thought as he descended the stairs to the passenger levels of the City Hall station. This was a holiday. He didn't want to think about work. What he wanted to do more than anything else was to get all his clothes laundered, read a few chapters of the new Stephen King novel, The Cannibals, and maybe wander up to Central Park to have some cheap-vended hot dogs with Vagabond and the cats. But then the uptown 7th Avenue Express had screeched into the station, and it had seemed like a good idea to step aboard. As the train sped uptown through Tribeca, the Village, and Chelsea, Jack noticed through the smeared panes that the stations seemed awfully busy for a holiday, at least this early. When he got off at Times Square and walked the block west in the tiled tunnels beneath 42nd, he overheard one transit cop disgustedly say to his partner,
What do you take a gander topside? Looks like a cross between spring break at Lauderdale and the Bronx Zoo. He came up for air at 8th Avenue, ascending out of the strong morning scent of disinfectant, barely masking the smell of vomit. The street population looked to Jack like any rush hour weekday morning, except that the average age looked fairly youthful, and gray suits had been replaced by considerably more garish attire. Jack stepped off the curb to avoid having to confront a swaggering trio of teenaged boys, normals by the look of them, who wore outrageous styrofoam headgear. The hats featured tentacles, drooping lips, segmented legs, horns, melting eyes, and other more unappetizing appendages that jiggled and bobbed with the wearer's movements. One of the boys put his thumbs to his cheekbones and wagged his fingers at passers-by.
"Ooga booga!" he cried. "We muties, we bad!"
His pals laughed uproariously. A block further, Jack passed one of the sidewalk sellers, peddling the foam hats.
"Hey," the vendor called. "Hey, come here, come here. You don't gotta be a joker to look like one. Today's your chance to act like one. You interested?"
Jack shook his head wordlessly, scratched the back of his hand, and walked on.
"Hey," yelled the man to another potential customer. "Be a joker for a day. Tomorrow you can go back to being yourself."
Jack shook his head. He wasn't sure now whether it would be better to go on being depressed or just go back and rip out the hat vendor's throat. He looked at his watch. 5 before 7. The bus would be in. The salesman's life was temporarily safe. The Port Authority building was a darker gray, bulking large in the chill gray of the Manhattan morning. Then Jack noted that most of the human traffic seemed to be exiting rather than entering the building. It reminded him of an Avenue A apartment after the exterminators set off their chemical bombs, an exodus of cockroaches carpeting every exit. He fought his way through one of the main doors, ignoring the hulking men importuning,
"Hey man, want a cab? Want an escort into your bus?"
Most of the storefronts along the interior promenade were locked and dark, but the snack bars were doing a land office business. Jack looked at his watch again. 7:02. Ordinarily, he would have stopped and appreciated the huge 42nd Street Carousel kinetic sculpture, a glass box enclosing a marvelous and musical Rube Goldberg contraption, but now there was no time. Less than no time. He checked the arrival board. The bus he wanted was coming in at a gate 3 levels up.
Merde!
The escalators were broken. Most of the foot traffic was coming down. Jack made his way up the stationary metal flights. He felt like a salmon struggling upstream to spawn. Only a minor current of the incoming tidal crest of humanity seemed to be the usual sorts of people who arrived in Manhattan by bus. Most seemed either to be tourists. Jack wondered whether this many people would actually be coming into the city for this particular holiday, or jokers themselves. Jack noted wryly that the normals were obliged by the constraints of the stairs and escalator steps to associate much more closely with jokers than they might otherwise have wished. Then someone elbowed him painfully in the side, and the opportunity for musing was over. By the time he reached the 3rd level and stepped outside the down-traveling crowd, Jack felt as if he'd used as much energy as he would normally burn climbing to the crown of the Statue of Liberty. Somebody in the crush patted him on the rear.
"Watch you, jerk," he said, without rancor, not looking.
He found the section holding the gate he wanted. The area was packed. It looked as if at least 6 coaches had arrived and were unloading simultaneously. He waded into the aimless melee and aimed himself at the right gate number. He stopped to allow 12 traditionally garbed nuns to move past him at right angles. A big joker with leathery skin and pronounced tusks protruding from beneath his upper lip tried to muscle through the nuns.
"Hey, move it, penguins," he yelled.
Another joker, one with huge puppy-like brown eyes and what appeared to be stigmata wounds on his palms, voiced exception. The shouting match looked as if it might escalate into something more violent. Naturally, an increasingly dense crowd of onlookers stopped to gawk. Jack tried to bypass the mess. He stumbled into an apparent normal who shoved back.
"Sorry."
The normal was well over 6 feet tall and proportionately muscled.
"Buzz off."
And then Jack saw her.
It was Cordelia. He knew that as surely as he knew anything, though he hadn't seen her before in his life. Elouette had sent pictures the Christmas previous, but the photographs didn't do the young woman justice. Looking at Cordelia, Jack thought, was like looking at his sister when she'd been 3 decades younger. His niece was wearing jeans and a sweatshirt. The sweatshirt was a faded crimson with screaming yellow letters spelling out Ferrick Jagger. Jack recognized the name, even though he wasn't terribly interested in heavy metal groups. He could also make out some sort of pattern made up of lightning bolts, a sword, and what looked like a swastika. Cordelia was about 10 yards away, on the other side of a thick flow of disembarking passengers. She held a battered floral print suitcase with one hand, a leather handbag with the other. A tall, slender, expensively dressed Hispanic man was trying to help her with the suitcase. Jack was instantly suspicious of any helpful stranger wearing a purple pinstripe suit, slouch hat, and a fur-trimmed coat. It looked like baby harp seal pelts.
"Hey!" Jack shouted. "Cordelia! Over here! It's me! Jack!"
She obviously didn't hear him. For Jack, it was like watching television, or perhaps the view seen through the wrong end of a telescope. He couldn't attract Cordelia's attention. With the noise of the terminal, the buses revving their engines, the massed roar of the crowd, his words wouldn't cross the intervening distance. The man took her suitcase. Jack yelled helplessly. Cordelia smiled. Then the man took her elbow and steered her toward a nearside exit.
"No!"
It was loud enough that even Cordelia turned her head. Then she looked puzzled briefly, before continuing toward the exit at the behest of her guide. Jack uttered a curse and started to pull and shove people out of his way as he tried to cross the waiting area. Nuns, jokers, punkers, street bums, it didn't matter. At least not until he fetched up against the bulk of a joker who looked to have the general shape and about half the mass of a Volkswagen Beetle.
"Going somewhere?" said the joker.
"Yes,"
said Jack, trying to move past.
"I come all the way from Santa Fe for this. I always heard you people here was rude."
A fist the size of a 2-slice toaster grabbed Jack's shirt lapels. Fetid breath made him think of a public restroom after rush hour.
"Sorry," said Jack. "Look, I've got to get my knees before a son of a bitch and pimp steals her out of here."
The joker looked down at him for a long moment.
"I can dig it," he said. "Just like on TV, huh?"
He let loose of Jack, and the latter scooted around him like rounding the flank of a mountain. Cordelia was gone. The nattily attired man guiding her was gone. Jack got to the exit where the two had presumably left. He could see hundreds of people, mainly the backs of their heads, but no one who looked like his niece. He hesitated only a second. There were 8 million people in this city. He had no idea how many tourists and jokers from all parts of the world had flooded into Manhattan for Wild Card Day. More millions, probably. All he had to find was 1 16-year-old from rural Louisiana. It was all instinct for the moment. Without thinking further, Jack headed for the escalators. Maybe he'd catch up with them before the man and Cordelia got outside, but if not, then he'd just find Cordelia on the street. He didn't want to think about what he'd tell his sister.
Spectre hadn't slept. He picked up the amber bottle of pills on the bedside table and dropped them into the trash. He'd have to find something stronger. The pain was always there, like the smell of stale smoke in a CD bar. Spectre sat up and breathed slowly. The early morning light made his apartment look even grayer than usual. He'd furnished the efficiency with cheap, beat-up junk from pawn shops and second-hand stores. The phone rang. "Hello?" "Mr. Spectre?" The voice had the refined edge of a Bostonian. Spectre didn't recognize it. "Yeah, who are you?" "My name is unimportant, at least for now." "Right." They were going to play cagey with him, but most people did. "So why are you calling me? What do you want?" "A mutual acquaintance named Gruber indicated that you have certain unique abilities. A client of mine might wish to employ you, initially on a freelance basis." Spectre scratched his neck. I think I see what you're getting at here. If this is some kind of a setup, you're a dead man. If you're legit, it's gonna cost you. Naturally. Perhaps you've heard of the Shadow Fist Society. It could be very profitable for you to work within that organization. However, they are cautious and would require a demonstration first. Would this morning be too soon? Word had it that the Shadow Fist Society was run by the city's anonymous new crime lord. They were leaning hard on the older gang bosses. Spectre would feel right at home in the upcoming bloodbath. I got nothing else to do. Who do you have in mind? That's really of no importance to us. He paused. Mr. Gruber seems to know quite a bit about you, and he's far from discreet. Fine by me. Be at Times Square at 11:30 this morning. If we're satisfied that you meet our needs, you'll be contacted there. What about money? Spectre heard a buzz at the other end. That will be negotiated later, if you'll excuse me. I have another matter to attend to. Goodbye, Mr. Spectre. Spectre dropped the receiver into the cradle. He smiled. Gruber wasn't one of his favorite people. He never gave anyone a fair price for their goods. Killing a greedy fence would be something of a public service. He walked naked to the bathroom and stared at the mirror. His stringy brown hair needed washing, and his mustache was overgrowing his thin upper lip. Other than that, he looked the same as the day he died, the day Tachyon had brought him back. Spectre wondered if he might not live forever. At this point, he didn't really care. He stuck out his tongue. His reflection didn't. It smiled at him.
"Don't worry, Demise," said his face in the mirror. "You can still die."
It laughed. He backed into the bedroom. The air was cold. There was a loud crackling sound. Spectre ran for the living room. The bedroom door slammed in his face. He smelled ozone.
Now, Demise. I only want to have a little chat.
Spectre recognized the voice now. He turned. The astronomer's projected self was sitting on the bed. He was wearing a black robe sashed at the waist with a rope of human hair. His crippled body was straighter than usual, which meant his powers were charged up. He was covered in blood. "What do you want?" Spectre was afraid. The astronomer was one of the few people his power didn't work on.
"Do you know what today is?"
"Wildcard Day. Everybody and his dog knows that." Spectre picked a pair of brown corduroy pants off the floor.
"Yes, but it's also something else. It's Judgment Day."
The astronomer knotted his fingers together. "Judgment Day?" He pulled his pants on. "What are you talking about?"
"Those bastards who ruined my plan. They intervened with our true destiny. They kept us from ruling the world."
The astronomer's eyes gleamed. There was a madness in them that even Spectre hadn't seen before.
"But there are other worlds. This one won't soon forget my parting shot at those fuckers who got in my way."
"Turtle, Tachyon, Fortunato, you're going after those guys?" Spectre clapped his hands softly. "Good for you."
"By the end of the day, they'll all be dead. And you, my dear Demise, are going to help me."
"Bullshit. I did your dirty work before, but not now. You fucking left me hanging out to dry, and I'm not going to give you another chance."
"I don't want to kill you, so I'll give you one chance to change your mind."
A rainbow of colored light began to swirl around the astronomer. "Fuck off, man." Spectre shook his fist. "You're not going to make a fool of me again."
"No. Then I'm afraid I'll have to make a corpse of you, along with all the rest."
The astronomer shifted into a jackal's head. It opened its mouth. Dark blood flowed steaming onto the carpeted floor. It howled. The building shook with sound. Spectre covered his ears and fell to the floor.
Fortunato called Caroline to come for Veronica. Caroline could take her to his mother's townhouse, the official business address for the escort agency. Caroline and half a dozen of the other women more or less lived there. He hustled Veronica into her clothes and then left her nodding out on the living room couch. Brennan said, "Is she going to be all right?" "I doubt it. I know it's none of my business, but weren't you maybe a little hard on her?" "It's under control," Fortunato said. "Sure it is," Brennan said. "I never said it wasn't." They stood and looked at each other for a few seconds. As yeoman, Brennan was probably the only one of the costume vigilantes running loose in New York that Fortunato trusted, partly because Brennan was still human, unaffected by the wildcard virus, partly because he and Fortunato had been through some serious shit together, inside a monstrous alien that some people called the Swarm. The astronomer called it Tiamat, and he'd used a machine he called the Shakti device to bring it to Earth. Fortunato had smashed the machine himself, but he was too late. The alien had already arrived, and hundreds of thousands around the world had died because of it. "What about the astronomer?" Fortunato said. "You know a guy they call the Walrus? Jube, the newsie." Fortunato shrugged. "Seen him around, I guess." "He saw the astronomer in Jokertown early this morning. Told Chrysalis about it. She mentioned it to me." "What did it cost you?" "Nothing. I know, it's out of character. But even Chrysalis is afraid of this guy." "Where does this Walrus know the astronomer from?" "I don't know." "So we've got a second-hand report by an unreliable witness and a cold trail?" "Back off, man. I tried the phone. The operator told me it was off the hook. This isn't even my fight. I came here to help you out." Fortunato looked at the mirror of Hathor. It could take him all day to get it purified and get himself focused enough to try it again. Meanwhile, if the astronomer had come out of his hole, it could be trouble. "Yeah. Okay. Let me take care of this other business, and we'll go take a look." By the time Fortunato had his street clothes on, Caroline had arrived. Even with her hair in short blonde tangles, wearing an old sweatshirt and jeans, she made Fortunato want her. She didn't look any older than she had 7 years ago, when he'd first taken her on. She had a child's face and a compact, energetic body whose every muscle seemed to be under her voluntary control. Fortunato loved all his women, but Caroline was special. She'd learned everything he could teach her: etiquette, foreign languages, cooking, massage. But her spirit had never cracked. He'd never mastered her, and maybe for that reason she could still give him more pleasure in bed than any of the others. He kissed her quickly when he let her in. He wished he could take her back into the bedroom and let her give him a shot of tantric power, but there wasn't time. "What do you want to do with her?" Caroline said. "Does she have a date tonight?" "It's wildcard day. Everybody has a date tonight. Mine should be over by midnight, and I may have to go out again if I get home too early." "Keep an eye on her. Let her go out if she seems all right, but keep her away from any more junk. I'll figure out the rest of it later." She looked at Yeoman. "Is something up?" "Nothing to worry about. I'll call you later." He kissed her again and watched her take Veronica down to the waiting cab. Then he looked at Brennan and said, "Let's go."
"Is that a lobster or is that a lobster?" Gills asked. He held it up for Hiram's inspection, and the lobster waved its claws feebly. The pincers were banded shut, and a few strands of seaweed draped the hard green shell. "A lobster of distinction," Hiram Worcester agreed. "Are they all that large?" "This is one of the small ones," Gills said. The Joker had mottled greenish skin and gill slits in his cheeks that pulled open when he smiled, showing the moist red flesh within. The gills didn't work, of course. If they had,
the elderly fishmonger would have been an ace instead of a joker. Outside, dawnlight was washing over Fulton Street, but the fish market was already busy. Fishmongers and buyers haggled over prices, refrigerator trucks were being loaded, teamsters shouted curses at each other, and men in starched white aprons rolled barrels along the sidewalks. The smell of fish hung in the air like a perfume. Hiram Worcester fancied himself a night owl, and on most days preferred to sleep in. But today was not most days. It was Wild Card Day, the day he closed his restaurant to the public and hosted the city's aces in a private party that had become a tradition, and special occasions made their own special demands, like getting out of bed when it was still dark outside. Gills turned away, replaced the lobster in its barrel.
"You want to see another one?"
he asked, tossing aside a handful of the wet seaweed and extracting a second lobster for Hiram's inspection. It was larger than the first, and more lively. It moved its claws vigorously.
"Look at him kick," Gills said. "Did I say fresh, or did I say fresh?"
Hiram's smile was a quick flash of white teeth through the black of his spade-shaped beard. He was very particular about the food he served in Aces High, and never more so than for his wild-card dinner.
"You never let me down," Hiram said.
"These will do handsomely. Delivery by 11, I assume." Gills nodded. The lobster waved its claws at Hiram and regarded him sourly. Perhaps it anticipated its fate. Gills put it back in the barrel. "How's Michael?" Hiram asked. "Still at Dartmouth?"
"He loves it there," Gills said. "He's starting his junior year, and already he's telling me how to run the business."
He put the top back on the barrel.
"How many you need?"
Hiram anticipated feeding about 150 persons, give or take a dozen. 80-odd aces, each of whom would bring a spouse, a lover, a guest. But of course lobster would hardly be the only entree. Even on this night of nights, Hiram Worcester liked to give his guests a choice. He had three alternatives planned, but these lobsters looked so splendid, undoubtedly they would be a popular choice, and it was better to have too many than too few. The door opened behind him. He heard the bell ring.
60, I think," Hiram said, before he realized that Gills was no longer paying attention.
The joker's oversized eyes were fixed on the door. Hiram turned. There were three of them. Their jackets were dark green leather. Two looked normal. One barely topped 5 feet, with a narrow face and a pronounced swagger. The second was tall and wide, a rock-hard beer belly spilling over his skull and crossbones belt buckle. He'd shaved his skull. The leader was an obvious joker, a cyclops whose single eye peered out at the world through a monocle with a thick Coke bottle lens. That was strange. Jokers and gnats didn't often run together. The cyclops took a length of chain out of the pocket of his jacket and began to wind it around his fist. The other two looked around Gill's establishment as if they owned the place. One began to kick at the sawdust with a heavy, scuffed-up boot.
"Excuse me," Gills said. I'll be right back."
He moved off towards the Cyclops, abandoning Hiram for the moment. Across the room, two of his employees leaned close and began to whisper together. A third man, a feeble-minded joker who'd been moving the wet sawdust around with a push-broom, gaped at the intruders and began to edge toward the back door. Gills was expostulating to the Cyclops, gesturing with his broad, web-fingered hands, pleading in a low, urgent tone. The youth stared down at him from that single, implacable eye, his face cold and blank. He kept wrapping the chain around his hand as Gills talked to him. Hiram frowned and turned away from the tableau. Trouble there, but it was none of his business. He had enough to think about today. He wandered down a sawdust-covered aisle to inspect a shipment of fresh tuna. The huge fish lay atop each other in rough-hewn wooden crates, their eyes fixed on him glassily. Blackened tuna, he thought. The inspiration brought a smile to his face. Labar was a genius at Cajun food. Not for tonight, that menu had been planned weeks ago, but blackened tuna would make an excellent addition to his regular bill of fare.
"Fuck that shit," the Cyclops said loudly from across the room. "You should have thought of that a week ago."
"Please," Gills said in a thin, frightened voice. "Just a few more days." The Cyclops put one booted foot up on a bin of fish, kicked, and sent it crashing over on its side. White fish spilled out all over the floor.
"Please don't," Gills repeated.
His employees were no longer in sight. Hiram turned and walked toward them, hands shoved casually into the pockets of his jacket. For such a huge man, his pace was surprisingly brisk. "Excuse me," he said to the Cyclops. "Is there a problem here?" The Joker youth towered over Gills, who was a small man made even smaller by his twisted spine. But Hiram Worcester was another matter. Hiram stood 6'2", and most people took one look at his girth and guessed that he weighed around 350 pounds. They were off by about 320 pounds, but that was another story. The Cyclops looked up at Hiram through his thick monocle and smiled nastily.
"Hey, Gills," he said, "how long you been selling whale?"
His companions, who had been standing by the door, trying to look bored and dangerous simultaneously, drifted closer.
"Look, it's a fucking Goodyear blimp," the short one said.
"Please, Hiram," Gills said, touching him gently on the arm.
"I appreciate it, but everything is fine here. These boys are friends of Michael's."
"I'm always pleased to meet friends of Michael's," Hiram said, staring at the Cyclops. "I'm surprised, though. Michael always had such good manners, and his friends have none at all. Gills has a bad back, you know. You really ought to help him clean up these fish you knocked over." Gills' face looked greener than usual.
"I'll get it cleaned up," he said. "Chip and Jim can do it. Don't worry about it."
"Why don't you leave, lard ass?" the Cyclops suggested. He glanced at the short kid.
"Cheech, get the door for him. Help him squeeze his fat ass right through."
Cheech stepped back and opened the door. "Gills," Hiram said, "I believe we were discussing terms on these excellent lobsters." The tall boy with the shaved skull spoke up for the first time.
"Make him squeal, aye," he said in a deep voice. "Make him squeal before you let him go."
Hiram Worcester looked at him with genuine distaste and a calm he did not really feel. He hated this sort of thing, but sometimes one was given no choice. "You're trying to intimidate me, but you're only making me angry. I doubt very much that you're actually friends of Michael's. I suggest you leave now, before this goes too far and someone gets hurt." They all laughed.
"Lex," I told the bald one, "it's too fucking hot in here. I'm sweating. Need some fresh air."
"I'll cool it right off," Lex said.
He looked around, grabbed a small barrel in both hands, hoisted it above his head in a single, smooth, powerful jerk, and took a step toward the big plate glass windows that fronted on Fulton Street. Hiram Worcester took his hands out of his pocket. At his side, his right hand curled into a tight, hard fist. A meaningless little tick, he knew. It was his mind that did it, not his hand. But the gesture was as much a part of him as his wild-card power. For an instant, he could see the gravity waves shifting hazily around the barrel like heat shimmers rising from the pavement on a hot summer's day. Then Lex staggered. His arms buckled, and a barrel of salt cod that suddenly weighed about 300 pounds came crashing down on his head. His feet went out from under him, and he hit the floor hard. The barrel staves shattered, burying Lex under the fish. Very heavy fish. His friend stared uncomprehending at first. Hiram stepped briskly in front of Gills and pushed the fishmonger away. "Go phone the police," he said. Gills edged backward. The short one, Cheech, tried to drag Lex out from under the shattered barrel. It was harder than it looked. The Cyclops gaped, then looked sharply back at Hiram.
"You did that," he blurted. "You're that fat man guy."
"I loathe that nickname," Hiram said. He made a fist, and Eye's monocle grew heavier. It fell off his face and shattered on the floor. The Cyclops screamed an obscenity and swung at Hiram's ample stomach with a chain-wrapped fist. Hiram dodged. He was a lot nimbler than he looked. His bulk varied, but he kept his weight at 30 pounds for years. I came after him, screeching. Hiram retreated, clenching his fist and making the Joker heavier with every step, until his legs collapsed under his own weight and he lay there moaning. Cheech was the last to make his move.
"You ace fuck," he said.
He held his hands out in front of him, palms flat, some kind of karate or kung fu or something. When he leapt, his metal-shod boot came pistoning towards Hiram's head. Hiram dropped to the sawdust. Cheech leapt right over him and kept going, weighing rather less than he had a moment ago. The force of his leap carried him into a wall, hard. He hit, rolled, tried to come up with a bounce, and discovered he was so heavy he couldn't get up at all. Hiram rose and brushed the sawdust off his jacket. He was a mess. he'd have to go home and change before going on to Aces High. Gills edged up to him, shaking his head. "Did you get the police?" Hiram asked. The old man nodded. "Good. The gravity distortion is only temporary, you know. I can keep them pinned down until the police arrive, but it takes a lot out of me." He frowned. "It's not healthy for them either. All that weight's a terrible strain on the heart." Hiram glanced at his gold Rolex. It was past 7:30. "I really have to get to Aces High. Damn, I didn't need this nonsense, not today. How long did the police—" Gills interrupted him. "Go, just go." He pushed at the larger man with gentle, insistent hands. "I'll handle it, Hiram. Please go." "The police will want me to give a statement," Hiram said. "No," Gills said. "I'll take care of it, Hiram. I know you meant well, but you shouldn't. I mean, well, you just don't understand. I can't press charges. Go, please, stay out of it. It will be better." "You can't be serious," Hiram said. "These hoodlums are my business," Gills finished for him. "Please, I ask you as a friend, stay out of it. Go. You will get your lobsters, very fine lobsters, I promise, but go," Gills insisted.
His hoarse grunts and the beat of his groin against hers set a counterpoint to the ticking of the bright yellow dime store baby bin alarm clock on the bedside table. Roulette pulled her topaz eyes from Stan's brown ones, watched the second hand sweeping smoothly across the face of the clock. Time. The ticking of a clock. The wash of blood through her veins driven by the inexorable beating of her heart. Fragments of time. Fragments marking the passage of a life. Ultimately, it came down to this. It respected neither wealth, nor power, nor saintliness. Sooner or later, it came and silenced that steady pulse, and she had her orders. Roulette reached up, softly touched Stan's temple. She drew breath, a gathering of will and power, but there was no release. It required hate, and all she felt was uncertainty. She lay back and summoned an image of horror, the agony of labor, knowing it would soon end and she would hold her child and all pain would be forgotten. The doctor's eyes widening in terror, struggling up to gaze at the thing between her legs. Her taut belly went flaccid, and an added warmth washed through her vagina, an imitation of passion as the poisonous tide flowed free. Howler's eyes suddenly bulged, his mouth worked, and he recoiled from her, his rapidly swelling cock rasping harshly along the soft tissues of her vagina with his abrupt withdrawal. Hands wrapped protectively about his quivering, discolored member, he gagged several times and emitted a choking scream. A glob of spittle ran over his chin in a thin thread, and the dresser mirror exploded in a crystal waterfall littering the bed with glass fragments. The baby bin took the edge of the spreading wave of sound, its crystal shattered, freezing the hands, and as the blow reached the clock's inner works, the alarm gave a tinny, dispirited squawk as if it were complaining about its sudden and unfair demise. Sound like a fist took Roulette across the right cheek, raising a mottled bruise on the café au lait skin, coaxing a trickle of blood from her ear. Indrawn breath caught in her throat like a jagged block, and sickness filled her belly. Howler's agonized face hung above her, and she knew she was looking at death. His chest was heaving, lips skinned back from teeth, and a tide of blue-black was rising from his now completely black and swollen penis into his groin and belly. The rumpled satin comforter gave no purchase to her flailing legs. She felt as if she were swimming on glass. With a final desperate flounder, she got to her knees and threw an arm around the Ace's chest. Her other hand tangled in his sweat-matted hair, and she yanked his head around so he faced the wall separating bedroom from living room. A life-ending, time-stopping scream echoed to the fringes of the universe and back again, and the wall exploded. Plaster dust spun in lazy spirals, catching at the throat and filling the nostrils. Rubble fanned across the living room floor and the far wall was bulging. For an instant, Roulette contemplated that sagging wall, pictured it falling, pictured the fat, lower-middle-class couple in the next apartment, staring at the tableau she would present. Naked woman holding naked man. Cock swollen to stallion proportions, whole body swelling as the poison exploded blood cells, the trail of the poison marked by blue-black discolorations. Another convulsion shook Howler, but his throat had swollen, closing off the vocal cords. The sweat-drenched skin of his back was cold and clammy against her flattened breasts, and the stink of released bladder and bowel filled the room. Gagging, she pushed him away, crawled off the bed, and huddled in on herself on the floor by the bed. Destruction at the cloisters. He had implied it was Turtle who had crumpled the stone walls. But he lied. He promised there would be no risk, even though this was the first ace she had ever killed. And he lied. She touched a hand to her ear and gazed in fascination at the congealed blood that stained her fingers. A sense of betrayal ate its way through to conscious thought and resolved itself into anger. He knew and didn't warn me. Had he wanted her to die here? But who then would kill Tachyon for him? Sirens reminded her of her danger. She had been so immersed in contemplation of death and betrayal that she had forgotten reality. No one in Lower Manhattan could have missed that death cry. She was running out of time, and if she wanted to survive, to attain her final goal, she too had to run. She pushed back her tangled hair, the tiny pearls and crystals braided into the long strands catching on her fingers, tugging at her scalp. She jammed stockings and garter belt into her purse, flung on her dress, and pushed her feet into high-heeled sandals. A last glance around the shattered room to see if she had left any trace of her presence, aside from the obvious one, of course, the bloated body on the bed. I always wanted to be special. An inarticulate cry burst from her, and she ran for the fire escape. One spiked heel slipped through the iron grating underfoot, and with a curse she pulled off the shoes. Holding one in each hand, she ran down the five flights to the first floor and lowered the ladder to the filthy, garbage-strewn pavement of the alley. Glass from 100 broken windows lay like a sparkling snowfall among rotting lettuce leaves, plastic six-pack dividers, stinking cans. It crunched underfoot as she reached the ground, and one splinter drove deep into her heel. She whimpered, pulled it out, and worked on her shoes. Tetanus shot. I'll need a tetanus shot. I haven't had one since that month Josiah and I spent in Peru. The thought of her ex-husband set memory in motion, jerking forward like a train gaining momentum. Images jostling and shattering like the frames of a nightmare film running at double speed, until no coherent pictures remained, just an undifferentiated blur of pain and grief and gut-burning fury culminating in a spewing sense of relief when she had released the tide and Howler had died. Out of the alley and onto the street, trying to set the right tone. It would be suspicious to simply ignore the insurance company's nightmare and Glazier's delight that surrounded her. Yet she could not bring herself to join the gaping, jostling throng, many still in pajamas and bathrobes, who gathered in clumps and gawked at the glass-littered street and the parked cars with frosted or demolished windows, better perhaps to ape a young working woman, interested but concerned with getting to work on time. A police car shot down the street, braked suddenly as it passed her, jerking the two occupants like test car dummies. Flat, bloodshot eyes raked over her, and she forced herself to face the cop's suspicious glance, though fear was fluttering in her belly. It was a predominantly white neighborhood, and though she was dressed with understated elegance, her dress was clearly for evening. Hooker. The thought read clearly on the bloated pink face, and she felt a stir of resentment. Class of 70, Vassar, master's in economics. Not a prostitute, you asshole. But she was careful to keep her expression neutral. A man ran out of Howler's apartment building, arms windmilling about his head, mouth opening and closing though no words could be heard over the cry of sirens. The cop, distracted, lost interest in roulette. He growled something to his partner, jerked his thumb toward the building. The car rolled on, and roulette forced herself back into motion. The fear was back, fueled not by the presence of the tangible pursuers who gathered behind her, but by the baying of her soul hounds who loped easily at her flanks. They were waiting for the time when the doubt and horror and guilt that had been growing with every kill would overwhelm her, bear her down, and then they would move in and destroy her. They were there now, waiting. She could hear them. She hadn't been able to hear them before. She was going insane, and if she killed again, what would happen? But she had to. And to have Tachyon dead would make even madness bearable.
Chapter 3. 8 a.m. The stone lions guarding the staircase before the main entrance of the New York City Public Library might as well have taken the day off. The library was closed and the staircase was deserted. Jennifer, having gone back to her apartment to have a light breakfast and to change into a conservative suit with a black skirt, black jacket, and white blouse, reached out and patted one on the side as she went by anyway, in seeming encouragement of a job well done. She let herself into the building with her key and then locked the door again behind her. The soles of her shoes clicked loudly, echoing eerily in the library's vast antechamber. "Morning, Miss Malloy," an old man wearing a rumpled uniform greeted her as she made her way through the cavernous central room back toward her desk near the first floor stacks. "Good morning, Hector. Not going to the parade?" The old man was one of the security guards. He liked to tell stories of when he'd seen Jet Boy battling the Zeppelins over Manhattan back when he was a cop and what it was like in the first few horrible moments of the new age when the wild card virus had been released and the world had changed suddenly and forever. "Maybe later," she said. She liked the old man, but now was not the time to get caught up in his interminable reminiscences. "I have some work to do, a project I want to finish." Old Hector clicked his tongue against his dentures and shook his head. "You work too hard, Miss Malloy. A pretty young thing like you. You should get out more." "I will. I just thought that today would be a good day to finish this project of mine, what with the library being closed and all." "I get your hint, I get your hint," the old man said good-naturedly, moving off along the darkened row of tables. "Never saw a girl like books so much and going out and having fun so little," he muttered half to himself. Jennifer went back into the stacks, keeping an eye on Hector, making sure he was going on his desultory rounds. It wouldn't do, she told herself, to have him come upon one of the reference librarians poring over a catalog with a couple of books full of rare stamps on her desk. It wouldn't do at all.
The noise level inside the Crystal Palace was still low enough to listen in on individual conversations, but Spectre wasn't interested in eavesdropping. He headed straight for the bar, sat down, and started drumming his fingers on the polished wood. Sasha, alone behind the bar, was busy making a Brandy Alexander for a blonde woman in a tight red and white cotton dress. Sasha's eyeless face gave Spectre the creeps. "Hey," Spectre said, just loudly enough to get Sasha's attention. "I need a double shot of Jack Black." "I'll be with you in a minute." Spectre nodded and pushed his hair back out of his eyes. He was too scared to eat, but he could always drink. Shit, he thought. I should have agreed to whatever he wanted. That twisted old fuck can make mincemeat out of me. He put his hand over his mouth and tried to slow his ragged breathing. He turned around, afraid that the astronomer might be right behind him. Only a few people would have the balls to start something at the Crystal Palace. But the astronomer wouldn't even think twice about it. God, I really don't want that bastard after me. Maybe he'll be too busy with the others. Even the astronomer will have trouble taking them all on. "Your drink." Spectre jumped at Sasha's voice, then turned around.
Thanks. He fished in his pocket for a five and tossed the crumpled bill onto the bar. Sasha hesitated for a moment, then picked up the money and walked away. Spectre picked up the glass and downed the whiskey. Gotta keep moving. Maybe he won't look for me in Brooklyn. He laughed softly to himself. Maybe the next president will be a joker. The air was chill and calm as he stepped outside. He rubbed his palms together and walked quickly down the street toward the nearest subway.
The first time she killed, it had been by accident. If such a thing can ever be termed an accident. And even now she could excuse it because toads like Sully really shouldn't be allowed to breed and multiply. She had lost her job. Her fingers tightened, and sugar and stale donut crumbs pattered onto the plastic plate. It had been presented as a leave of absence, but she knew better. For weeks, the whispers had haunted her, creeping about the corners of the office partitions, echoing in the washrooms, leaving a tangible mark on every face. Poor thing. Husband is divorcing her. Is it true? She had a monster. Several of her pregnant friends dropped her, as if her very presence could mutate their child. And the fear was not helped by a disquieting rumor out of the CDC that two anomalous cases of the wild card virus had arisen that could only be explained if the disease was in fact contagious. Frank had been kind that day when he called her into his office, but very firm. Her presence in the office was affecting worker morale and productivity, and didn't she really need some time alone to come to grips with what had happened to her? So why not take a little time? Weeks later, money running low and her spirits just as low, she found Sully Thornton at her door. He was a pathetic little toady who continually brayed about being one of Josiah's business associates. Roulette had never particularly noticed him doing any business when he had been present at Smallwood's. Instead, he had concentrated on lapping up all the free booze he could hold and trying to press soggy, drunken kisses on her whenever he caught her alone. She had slapped him once, and after a neighing titter that set his prominent Adam's apple to bobbing, he had boozily explained that he was just emulating old Grandpa Thornton with his fascination for dusky women. Just runs in the blood. Yeah, she thought sourly, like whooping on the boys and fucking the mammies. Just comes natural. Sully had mouthed something about wanting to look her up because Josiah had treated her so bad. And could he buy her dinner? And he'd heard she had lost her job, and did she need a little loan? She didn't miss the meaning, and despite her revulsion with the man she accepted, being broke ruins a person's standards. Late that night, as he had lain groaning and panting atop her, she had remembered the bone-cracking release as her baby was born, and raised herself up on her elbows, and had seen, no! Then had come a release of another kind, and Sully had died. Her eaters of the soul had begun to torment her within hours of Sully's death, and if Judith had not found her, perhaps she would have ceased to deal in death. But the astronomer's ace hound did find her and took her to the cloisters, and the astronomer had spoken to her hidden places, nurturing her festering hate, promising that she would have her final revenge, and that when the last kill was made, he would give her peace, remove forever the memory of her child. The astronomer had used her sparingly, eager to keep her secret and very effective, and she was effective. Today marked the third kill she had made for her awful master, and each time it was worse. She gulped down some of the Sunshine Cafe's enamel-stripping coffee, trying to wash away the sick taste of death that lay on her tongue. This time he would know. He would sense her guilt and doubt and react, and she was scared to disappoint. No, she was just scared. terrified of him, of his powers, of his obsessive drive to destroy. First Tiamat, now those who had denied him his ultimate victory. What if she never went back? No. Without him, there could be no final catharsis, no final release from the memory of monsters. He could have all the rest, but Tachyon was hers. The alien had destroyed her life. She would repay him by destroying his. That was her obsession, and it had wedded her to the astronomer in an unholy union of hate and vengeance. And it was far stronger a bond than love. "Lady, I don't rent tables by the hour," growled the proprietor of the Sunshine Cafe, who was living proof that the generators of cheerful advertising were under no obligation to follow it. She tossed money onto the table and decided to be grateful for the interruption rather than irritate it. Her greasy spoon haven had been removed. She had to go to face him.
Normally, Hiram liked to ride through the city streets, to watch the ebb and flow of the human drama on the sidewalks of Manhattan through the frosted glass windows of his Bentley, while his driver worried about gridlock and kamikaze cabs. But today, Jokertown and surrounding neighborhoods would be chaos, as the Jokers took to the streets and thousands of tourists flowed into the city for the parades, street fairs, fireworks, and other celebrations that marked Wildcard Day. To avoid the crush, Hiram told Anthony to take the FDR drive, and even so the traffic was a horror. He would have preferred to return to his apartment to change, but there wasn't time. They went directly to the Empire State Building. Velvet ropes had been hung in front of the express elevators to Aces High, and a tasteful gold-lettered sign said "Closed for Private Party." Hiram hopped over the rope lightly, no feet at all for a man who weighed only 30 pounds, but had always raised a few eyebrows in the lobby. The elevator took him straight up to the restaurant's foyer. As the doors opened, he heard his head chef shouting at someone. The saucier, no doubt. They were constantly arguing. The janitor was sweeping out the cloakroom as Hiram emerged from the elevator. "Make sure you empty the ashtrays, Smitty," Hiram told him. He paused a moment, looked around the room. The marble floor was gleaming, the couches had been freshly cleaned, all the walls were hung with framed photographs of celebrities. Politicians, sports figures, sex symbols, socialites, writers, film stars, newsmen, and a myriad of aces. Most had scrawled warm personal inscriptions to Hiram across their likenesses. He stopped to straighten the picture of Senator Hartman and the howler that had been taken the night the senator had been re-elected, then swept through the wide double doors into the restaurant itself. Paul Labar's voice was much louder in here, even through the hubbub. Workmen were setting up round banquet tables for the party and moving everyday tables into storage. Cleaning crews were polishing the floors, the long curved bar, and the magnificent Art Deco chandeliers that gave Aces High so much of its ambience. The wide doors to the Sunset Terrace had been thrown open to air out the room, and a stiff New York wind was blowing. Dimly, from far below, Hiram could hear the sounds of traffic and police sirens. Curtis, his maitre d' and good right arm, came up to Hiram Worcester with a dozen stiff pieces of poster board under one arm. He was a tall, slender black man with white hair. Tonight, in his tuxedo, he would look splendid, elegant, even a bit austere. Right now, dressed in a flannel shirt and a pair of worn dungarees, he just looked harried. "The kitchen is in chaos," he announced briskly. "Paul insists that Miriam has ruined his special hollandaise and he's threatening to throw her off the Sunset Terrace. We had a small fire in the kitchen, but it's out, no damage. The ice sculptures are late, 6 of our waiters phoned in sick this morning. Carnival flu, I call it, complicated by the fact that no one ever tips at these private parties. A larger bonus might affect a sudden remission. The usual rumor about Golden Boy has made the rounds, and I've had 3 calls from guests anxious to let us know that if he was coming, they weren't. Oh, and Digger Downs phoned up to tell me that if he isn't admitted tonight, Aces Magazine will never mention the restaurant again. And how are you this morning, Hiram?" Hiram sighed, ran a hand across his bald head in a nervous gesture left over from the days he'd had hair. "Tell Digger I'll let him in if his editor promises in writing that we'll never be mentioned in Aces again. Get me 6 temp waiters. No, make that 10. They won't be as good as our regular people. I'm not worried about Paul. He hasn't thrown anyone out a window yet." He strode toward his office. Curtis matched him pace for pace.
There's always a first time. What about Golden Boy?
Hiram made a rude noise.
We get the same rumor every year, and Mr. Braun has yet to show up. If he ever does, I'll deal with the question of his dinner.
Who's threatening to cancel?
Sparkle Johnny, Trump Card, and Pit Boss, Curtis said.
Reassure Shauna and Lou, Hiram told him. And tell Sparkle Johnny that Golden Boy is definitely going to be here.
Are those the seating charts?
Curtis handed them over.
I'll call Calvin and check on the ice sculptures,
he said as Hiram unlocked the door to his private office.
Out the window!
Paul LeBar was screaming in the kitchen.
All the way down you can think of the proper way to make hollandaise. Perhaps it will come to you before you hit.
Hiram winced. Do that, he said. And please have someone do me up a small breakfast. An omelette, I think. Tomato, onion, crumbled bacon, cheese. Cheddar? Hiram raised an eyebrow. Well, of course. Four eggs with pommes frites and a carafe of orange juice, a little Earl Grey. Are there biscuits? Curtis nodded. Good. Three, please. I'm weak with hunger. Using his powers always left him famished. Dr. Tachyon said it had something to do with energy loss.
Anthony will be back soon with a clean suit. I had a bit of an altercation down on Fulton Street.
Send someone to the lobby to wait for it. If Anthony tries to bring it up, the Bentley will probably be towed. He closed the door. A 26-inch color television was mounted on the wall above his desk. Hiram seated himself in a huge, custom-designed leather executive's chair that smelled like the inside of a very old and very exclusive British men's club. Turned on his built-in back massager, spread the seating charts out across the black walnut, and flicked on the television with a jab at the remote control. Willard Scott and Peregrine appeared on the screen. Willard was wearing moose ears for some reason. Peregrine was wearing as little as she could get away with. They were talking about the Jokertown parade. Hiram hit the mute button. He liked to keep the television on as he worked, a sort of video wallpaper that kept him plugged into the world, but the noise distracted him. After a final glance at Peregrine's admirable costume, he began reviewing the charts, initialing each in the lower right-hand corner after he'd looked it over. By the time Curtis returned with his omelette, Hiram had finished the charts. Two changes, he said. Put Mistral over by the terrace. If it gets too windy, she can take care of it for us. Switch Tacky and Croyd. If we put Tacky on at the same table with Fortunato, we'll have innocents killed in the crossfire. Excellent, Curtis said. Six tables for the At the Doors? Formal invitations were sent out annually to the wildcard day dinner at Aces High, and RSVPs were expected. But there were aces who carefully kept their names secret, and others who'd yet to come out of the deck. The party was open to all of them, and each year the queue of those hoping to win admission by demonstrating an ace talent at the door grew longer and longer. Eight tables, Hiram said after a moment's reflection. This is the 40th anniversary, after all. He glanced up at the television screen again. One more thing. He took back the top chart, made a notation. There. Curtis studied it. Peregrine next to you. Very good, sir. I thought so, Hiram said with a quiet smile. He felt rather pleased with himself. The ice sculptures will be delivered within the hour.
Excellent. Notify me when they arrive.
Curtis closed the door behind him. Hiram leaned back in his chair, glanced up at the TV set, changed the channel. On the steps of Jet Boy's tomb, Linda Ellerby was interviewing Xavier Desmond. He watched them mouth silent words for a minute. Then a news bulletin interrupted their conversation. Something about the Howler, whose picture flashed up on the screen wearing his yellow fighting clothes. A nice fellow, but his color sense was almost as bad as Dr. Tachyon's. Hiram frowned and steepled his fingers thoughtfully. Everything was under control, the party would be a smashing success, the social occasion of the year. He ought to be feeling elated. Instead, he was troubled. The business down at the Fulton Street fish market, that was it. He couldn't get it off his mind. Gills was in some kind of trouble. He needed help. Hiram was fond of the old joker. They'd been doing business for a decade, and Aces High had even catered his son's graduation. Someone ought to find out what was going on, Hiram thought. Not him, of course. He was a restaurateur, not an adventurer. Still, he knew all the right people, and many of them owed him favors. Perhaps he ought to use his contacts. Hiram found Dr. Tachyon's number on his Rolodex, picked up his telephone, punched out the number. He let it ring a long time. The Takesian was a notoriously late sleeper. Finally, he gave up. Wildcard Day was always a trial for Tachyon. As often as not, it set him off on binges of guilt, self-pity, and cognac. This being the 40th anniversary, the doctor's angst could be particularly acute. Oh, Dr. Tachyon would be on time for dinner, no doubt of that, but Hiram wanted to get someone working on this immediately. He thought for a minute. His good friend, Senator Hartman, would lend him the services of some Justice Department ace, undoubtedly, but involving the government was time-consuming and messy. Fortunato might help, but then again he might not. He turned his Rolodex, looking at the names, and of course it was right there, on the very first card. J. Aykroyd, Confidential Investigations, and Sleight of Hand. Smiling, Hiram Worcester picked up the phone and dialed. Aykroyd got it on the fifth ring. "It's too early," the PI complained. "Go away." "Out of bed, Popinjay," Hiram said cheerfully, knowing it would irritate him. "The early bird gets the worm, and tonight you'll be solving for your supper, so to speak." "It'd better be more than one supper, Hiram," Aykroyd said. "And don't call me Popinjay, damn it."
Each stock book had 10 pages, and each page held about 100 stamps, with their Scott Postage stamp catalog numbers written in neatly below them, making them very easy to identify. There were 10 Ireland number 38, Great Britain number 171, overprinted Rialtar, Shaladach, Nahenion, 1922, in blue-black ink. Mint, catalog value, $1,500 each. There were 8 Denmark number 1, in perforate, with yellow-brown bourrelage, lightly canceled with 4 excellent margins, catalog value, $1,300 each. There were 12 Japan number 8, native-laid paper without gum, mint, catalog value, $450 apiece. And on and on and on. Altogether, there were 1,880 stamps in the stock books, cataloging on the average about $1,000 each, so that each stock book held about $1 million worth of stamps. The third book, though. Jennifer flipped through the pages rapidly, but her mind was drawn from the mystery of the third book by the wealth in the other books on the cluttered desk before her. Kian had put together quite a little collection. She didn't know much about philately, but a quick perusal of the pricing information in the front of the catalogs and her general experience in the field of rare and collectible materials told her that Kian had assembled the perfect collection for realizing maximum profit when it came time to sell. The stamps he had gathered were rare, but not exceedingly rare. The really rare stamps were so well known that all extant examples of them were documented. But enough of these issues existed so that they were untraceable. They were rare enough to be, well, rare, and common enough so that their appearance in the market wouldn't cause a stir. They were also rare enough so that, depending, of course, on how desperate he was at the time he liquidated his holdings, Kian could expect to get near catalog price for them when he wanted to turn them into something more negotiable. A quick check of several selected issues and catalogs from previous years told her that they were also rare enough to increase in value every year. And if Kian played the proper cards when cashing them in, he wouldn't have to pay taxes on them. Of course, a single stamp dealer would have a hard time coming up with enough cash to purchase the entire collection. But there were a lot of stamp dealers in any given large city. Unfortunately, Jennifer reflected as she idly scanned the pages of stamps, she didn't have that option. She couldn't break up the collection piecemeal. She had to get rid of it at once, and she'd be fortunate if her fence would give her 10% of value for them. Still, 10% would be nice. 200,000 isn't bad for a morning's work. She had a big balloon payment coming up on her apartment that had recently gone condo, and then there were her special projects. She took a small black book out of her purse and scanned her list of favorite charities, mostly small, poorly funded centers for battered wives, deserted children, and abandoned animals. In the current age of government cutbacks, private citizens had to do all they could to support worthy causes, and there were, Jennifer thought, an awful lot of worthy causes in the world.
Moisture was seeping from a long crack, running diagonally across the wall of the tunnel. The entire weight of Manhattan seemed poised above her head, and she wondered for the 100th useless time whether this rabbit warren of tunnels and tiny rooms would survive. Maybe her footsteps would be the final stress needed to bring down the crumbling layer. Fear pushed breath deep into her abdomen, and she hurried forward, moisture seeping in the sides of her sandals. It seemed incredible to her that after the debacle in May, when the Aces of New York had stormed the cloisters, killing a number of masons and destroying the Shakti device, that the astronomer had calmly returned to his old haunts and no one had noticed. True, there were only a handful of them left. Kafka, the master himself, Roman, Kim Toy, Gresham, Imp, and Insulin, and her, saved because she had chosen to spend that day at a concert in upstate New York. Perhaps the threat from the swarm, only recently removed, could offer some explanation. The tunnel debouched into a small room. Roulette entered and felt her heel slide from beneath her as she hit the slick dark blood that lay in ever-widening pools on the stone floor. It had been an energetic ritual, for bright blood also painted the walls. A garish red, freckling here, flowing rivulets there, all washing across the sweating gray plaster. A modern art exhibition drawn in savagery. Dismembered limbs lay stacked like corded wood in a far corner, the head with its staring eyes placed like a melon on the top. She had been a pretty woman, her long dark hair caressing the jagged stump of her neck, crystal earrings flashing in the harsh light of a naked bulb that swung from a cord in the ceiling. Still life for a madman, thought Roulette, and hysteria and revulsion pulled her throat taut. Kafka, looking positively Dadaesque as he doubled as a towel rack, hunched beside the astronomer. Several fluffy towels with applique teddy bears hung over his chitinous skeletal arms. His carapace was rattling, but whether with cold or fear, Roulette couldn't tell. Finally, she forced her eyes to her master, who finished fastidiously wiping his hands on a towel and dropped it onto the floor at his feet. His eyes swam like enormous moons behind the thick lenses of his glasses, but he was vibrant, fairly crackling with energy, and she knew he was ready to begin the day's agenda. A blood feast now to prepare for the banquet to follow. Well, Howler is dead. Excellent, my lovely dear. Excellent. He turned and contemptuously pushed aside his wheelchair. Its wheels creaked mournfully as it rolled into a corner. But tell me all. Every subtle nuance, every agonized grimace. It wasn't very subtle, she said flatly, and pushed back her braided hair to reveal the bruise. And I still can't hear very well out of my right ear. He laughed, deep-throated bass rumble that left her shaking with fury. I could have died. Doesn't that matter to you? Not tremendously. His eyes were on her, and she writhed, unable to meet his gaze. You could have at least warned me, she cried, trying to find a safe place to rest her eyes. But everywhere she looked, there was madness. I am not your daddy. I assumed you had enough intelligence to do your own research. I'm not a professional killer. I don't research. Even Kafka emitted a whispering, panting chuckle that sounded like dry, dead hands being rubbed together. And the astronomer threw back his head and roared, the tendons in his skinny neck standing out like twigs. Oh, my precious dear, is that how you hide from your soul? You little fool, you should embrace the hate. Lick it, eat it, revel in it. I am offering you a unique opportunity to find vengeance, to repay loss with pain, and after it's all over, I'll give you the freedom you crave. You should thank me. I'm becoming a monster, Roulette murmured. Is this doubt I'm hearing? Then please squash it. Guilt is a most debilitating emotion. It makes you weak. You see, doubt can lead to betrayal, and you know how I deal with those who betray me. I'm giving you Tachyon, though I really want to kill him myself. So don't come bleating about how close you came to death and how awful I am for making you kill. And don't even think about backing out. I haven't time to deal with the good doctor myself. I've even had to delegate Turtle to Imp and Insulin. So I would be very upset with you if I had to add Tachyon back into my agenda. The pleasure wouldn't outweigh the aggravation, believe me. I don't think you were motivated by generosity. I think you're afraid of him. That's why you're sending me to face him. The words were gone, and she was a fool for uttering them, for he was upon her, fingers closing like a vice about her jaw. Calling me a coward, my sweet pussy killer. His face was set in a devil's grimace. No, she forced out the barely audible whisper. Good. I wouldn't want to think that you didn't respect me. Now, tell me about Howler. No, I don't. I can't live it again. She towered over him, so she was gazing down on the top of his balding cranium, covered only with a few straggling wisps of hair and patches of scabrous skin. Then live this. And the rush of memory returned. The hideous misshapen thing that had lain between her legs. The net result of so many hours of painful labor. A monster so grotesque that even the nurses had hated to touch it. All right, all right. He was in great pain. His face, what of his face? He must have been looking at you. He looked sad, like a bewildered child who couldn't understand why he was being hurt. Sobs lay like jagged glass in the back of her throat. And did you enjoy it? His free hand closed about her left shoulder, and he forced her to her knees before him. She could feel the blood soaking through the hem of her skirt, sticking on the bare skin of her knees. His eyes were on her again. There was no hope of lying. No. The tears spilled over, running in hot lines over her cheeks. I didn't really know him, just one night. But he was kind to me, and now he's dead. And I'm afraid. Of what? Of what I'm becoming. I'm afraid to go on. My dear, you had best be afraid of what will happen if you don't go on. I own you, Roulette. And I will exact a terrible punishment if you fail me. A shrill scream tore at her throat as she watched his hand go sliding into her chest and felt the heavy pressure as he cupped her heart in his palm. One squeeze, Roulette, and you die. His hand drifted down, massaging her ovaries, sending waves of agony through her belly. Don't make me kill you, Roulette. It would be such a waste. He removed his hand and caressed her bruised cheek. But I don't want to frighten you, my darling. I want to help you, to save and free your soul. You will go mad, Roulette, just as you fear, unless you achieve your final vengeance and purge your soul. Without that cleansing, my memory wipe will do you no good. Now go find Tachyon. Kill him. and you will be free.
Free? She sighed.
The astronomer suddenly released his hold on her chin, and she fell forward, catching herself on her hands. She whimpered a bit as the now congealing blood oozed between her fingers. Even free from you, she thought with an emotion that was neither love nor hate, but partook of both. Yes, my little love, even from me. She squeezed her eyes shut, waiting for the blow or other punishment that had to follow. Moments passed, and nothing happened. Cautiously, she opened her eyes. And when will you remove your past? When you report back to me and tell me in painful detail. His lips quirked at the little pun. Every moment of Tachyon's death.
Yes. All right. I will.
Roulette pushed herself to her feet. With a jerk of the head, the astronomer indicated to Kafka to leave. The hideous little cockroach Joker scurried to the door and offered Roulette one of the remaining clean towels. She accepted gratefully. Will I find you here? That depends on the time. My schedule's rather full today. He smirked, then stared consideringly at her. You have served me well. Oh, why not? I've decided to take my more faithful followers with me when I leave. He wrapped a length of flexible tubing about his upper arm and rubbed at the bulging vein.
Leave?
Yes, I'm leaving this world which betrayed and cheated me. But how? On Tachyon's ship. But you don't know how to fly a spaceship. Do you? She added, suddenly doubtful. The range of his powers was awesome. Maybe he could. This ship will fly, for it's an intelligent creature with a mind, and what has a mind, I can control. We are set to rendezvous at 3:30 tomorrow morning. Be there, and you can come. Provided, of course, you've killed Tachyon. And if your little recitation pleases me, now, what do you say to that? I couldn't be any fairer, he added, in a thoughtful tone as he considered his own magnanimity. The little smile that pursed his mouth died, and his face twisted in a hideous grimace. Now go, he screamed, and spittle foamed in tiny white specks on his lips and spattered on her face. She went, running back down the damp tunnel, towel pressed to her lips. Kafka was still shuffling down the tunnel, and as she passed him, Roulette wondered how much he had overheard, if he constituted one of the faithful, and what the astronomer would do to him if he weren't, and if he learned of Kafka's eavesdropping. For an instant their eyes met, and Roulette saw mirrored in the Joker's the same fear and confusion and hopelessness and hate that she knew lay reflected in hers. She touched him gently on the carapace. Thank you for the towel, Kafka.
You're welcome,
he said with an odd formality that made his bizarre condition all the more ludicrous and heartbreaking.
Roulette, he added as she walked away. Be careful. I would like to think that one of us came out of this with some semblance of normalcy and humanity intact.
Well, it won't be me. But thanks for the concern.
Chapter 4, 9 a.m. Jennifer picked up the phone on her desk and dialed a number she'd used only a half a dozen times in the past year, but had committed to memory. It rang three times before it was picked up, and a rich, cultured voice with a Brooklyn accent still lurking in it said, "The Happy Hawker." Hello, Gruber. The voice took on a new tone, deepening and becoming unctuous with unwanted solicitousness. My dear Wraith, he called her by the nom de guerre Jennifer had adopted. It's been a while. How have you been? Fine. Jennifer kept her answers to a minimum. She didn't like Leon Gruber, though he continually let her know his all-too-evident feelings toward her. He was a pudgy, pasty-faced cokehead with a master's in fine arts from Columbia. He worked out of the pawn shop he'd inherited from his father, under, from what Jennifer had heard, rather suspicious circumstances. He was her fence. He never stopped hitting on her, despite the cold politeness with which she carried out all of their transactions. "Do you have something for me?" he asked. He made the question sound salacious. Jennifer could almost see him licking his pouty lips. "Postage stamps," she replied briefly. "How much?" There was something of a sigh in his voice as he resigned himself to talking business. "Nearly 2 million catalog." There was a long silence, and when Gruber finally spoke, his voice had changed again. There was something behind his words that Jennifer had never heard before, something that made him sound even more cold and calculating than usual. "You do astonish me, my dear. Tell me, are these from a dealer's stock or a private party's collection?" "None of your business." "Well, we do like to keep our little secrets, don't we?" "My secrets are my own," Jennifer said firmly, more than a little irritated. "If you're not interested in the stamps, I can always find someone who is." "Oh, I am interested. I am. I'm interested in everything about you, my dear Wraith." Jennifer grimaced at his words. She could almost imagine the scenes flickering through his coked-up brain. "You are a very, intriguing person. You appeared from out of nowhere, and in less than a year became the city's finest thief. I feel very fortunate to be, associated with you, and I'm very, very interested in the stamps. I have something on for this morning, though. I'm expecting some people. Can you come by 11-ish? Perhaps we can do lunch after I take a look at the merchandise." "Perhaps." There was no sense in antagonizing him before he looked at the stamps. 11. I'll be there." "I'll be waiting, dear." His last sentence echoed oilily in Jennifer's ear as she hung up. There was more avid anticipation in it than was usual. She decided that she had to find a new fence. She couldn't take Gruber's leering comments much longer. Maybe he was sliding too deeply into his cocaine habit. "He does so much of this stuff," Jennifer thought. "One of these days, his heart'll explode."
Fortunato checked his watch. He had to bring his arm up along his side and then across his chest to see it because of the crowds. It was a little after 9. When he looked up again, the world was like a kaleidoscope. Shards of bright color surrounded him, shifting constantly into new patterns, unpredictable, but not quite random. When Caroline had said it was wildcard day, it had meant nothing to him. He should have known better. Now he was trapped in the crowds with Brennan, committed. Every couple of minutes he thought again about breaking his rule about public displays. It would be nothing for him to levitate himself out of the crowd and sail back to the peace of his apartment. Then he thought of the astronomer, maybe just a few yards away, maybe on the verge of killing again and making himself that much stronger in the process. Just ahead of them, Hester Street met the Bowery, square in the middle of Jokertown. Police barricades blocked off the side streets, though there were so many tourists a car couldn't have gotten through if it wanted to. They mostly seemed to be dressed for a track meet, in shorts and running shoes and hideous t-shirts, except they were overweight and slung with cameras and had billed caps with moronic slogans on them.
"Look, there's one now,"
one of them said, pointing at Fortunato. The man's hat said, "Eating out is fun." Fortunato thought about turning the man's stomach inside out, leaving it hanging out of his mouth by the long tube of his esophagus, spilling his blood and drool and breakfast on the sidewalk. "Easy," he told himself. "Just take it easy." In typical Joker fashion, the parade had already gone to hell. The official floats were supposed to be lining up down at Canal, but the street was already full of unofficial entries, the most obvious of which was a 20-foot-high latex phallus, pink and glistening, pointing up at about 60 degrees. It was mounted on a wooden platform, and 3 masked jokers were trying to push it through the crowds. The penis was forked, and there was a sign hanging between the 2 heads that said, "Fuck the Nats." A 4th joker stood on the platform, throwing what looked like used condoms into the crowd. 2 knots of people were fighting their way toward the platform, 1 cops, the other outraged tourists. "There he is!" Brennan had to shout in Fortunato's ear to make himself heard. Fortunato turned and saw Jube sitting on top of his news kiosk, short, fat, his tusks glistening in the morning sunlight. "Okay," Fortunato said. He used a little of his power to clear a space in front of the kiosk. He cupped his hands and called up to him. "Can you come down for a minute?" Jube shrugged and started to clamber down. Fortunato reached up and took hold of a black, rubbery ankle to steady him. At the moment of contact, Fortunato felt a weird vibration go through him. Jube looked down, and their eyes locked. Fortunato read his thoughts involuntarily. "Yes," Fortunato answered him. "Now I know." Jube was not human.
"I've seen you at the Crystal Palace," Jube said, "but we've never been formally introduced."
He held out a hand.
"How are you at keeping secrets?"
"I mostly mind my own business," Fortunato said. "Does Tachyon know about you?"
"No, nobody does but you. I guess I just have to hope you don't come up with a good reason to give me away."
Jube's face went blank as Brennan walked up and said,
"Chrysalis told me. I saw the astronomer."
Jube's head, greasy black and covered with tufts of reddish hair, moved up and down.
"About 5 this morning. I was picking up the Inquirer every Monday, you know."
Fortunato cleared his throat impatiently.
"He was in the back of a limo, headed down 2nd Avenue."
"How did you know it was him?" Fortunato asked. Jube hesitated, and Fortunato made it in order. "Tell me the truth."
"I went to some of their meetings, the Egyptian Masons. I thought they had something I wanted."
A sudden crash made the alien jerk back in surprise. Fortunato turned around. Just across Hester, a plate glass window had exploded out onto the street. 4 Oriental kids in blue satin jackets swarmed out of the store. The last one out smashed the glass of the door with a billy club.
"You remember, old man," the kid shouted. "You don't fuck with the egrets, man."
They charged into the crowd and disappeared. Brennan had the leather case open and the 2 halves of his bow together in 1.5 seconds. Even so, he had no chance for a shot. He put the bow away again and turned back to Fortunato. Fortunato hadn't moved.
"You weren't kidding," Jube said. "You really do mind your own business."
"I don't interfere where I don't know what's going on," Fortunato said. He was thinking about 1969, when his power had first appeared. For a few months there, he'd been involved with a political underground movement, trying to stop the wholesale slaughter of jokers in Vietnam. Even then, with the issues as clear as they'd been, he felt uneasy about it. There had been a woman involved, and when she disappeared, that had been the end of it for him. And since then, he'd kept to himself. "If I wanted to be a cop, I'd be a cop." He turned back to Jube. "I think you and me need to sit down and have a long talk sometime, when there's not so much going on. For right now, just keep your eyes open. If you see the astronomer again, or anybody that you know is working for him, call Tachyon. He can get a hold of me, all right?" The alien nodded. "And for Christ's sake," Fortunato said, "try to cheer up."
Spectre walked slowly up the steps of the subway station, glancing in all directions. The Jack Daniels hadn't helped. He'd seen the astronomer kill before. He'd even been in on it several times. The old man could tear him to pieces faster than he could regenerate. He shuddered and stumbled on. Gruber's pawn shop was only a couple of blocks away.
Flatbush Avenue was quiet, almost deserted. A kid was playing on a stoop, holding a jet in one hand and a blimp in the other. He smashed the plane into the side of the blimp and yelled, "I can't die yet! I haven't seen the Jolson story!" Spectre shook his head. He didn't understand why anyone considered Jet Boy a hero. The little shit had tried to stop the virus from being released over New York, but he fucked up, failed. For that, he got a statue in the adoration of millions. "Jet Boy was a loser!" he yelled at the kid. The boy stared at him, then picked up his toys and scrambled inside. Spectre reached inside his gray suit and pulled out his death's head mask. He slipped it on when he was across the street from the Happy Hawker. Spectre crossed the street quickly and tried the door. It was locked. Spectre banged loudly on it several times and waited. No sound. He tried again. This time there were heavy, hurried footfalls. He heard the lock click, and the door opened a crack. "I'm busy right now. Come back later," Gruber said. "You've got coke on your lapel," Spectre said, pointing at the tailored tweed suit. He put his foot in the door. "It's Spectre. I need to buy something." Gruber opened the door and closed it quickly when Spectre was inside. "Buying? That's a bit unusual. Well, what do you need?" "An automatic pistol and a flak jacket." Spectre looked around at the dimly lit clutter. The place smelled of disuse and Gruber's cologne. "How do you ever find anything in here?" "All the important business is transacted in back." Gruber opened the cage and walked into the back room. He was fat and soft. Spectre could have hated him just for that. He followed the little man, bringing his pain into focus. Gruber opened a cabinet and pulled out a pistol. "Ingram Mac-11 with shoulder holster. I'd want 800 from a normal customer, but you can take it out and trade. You will have something soon for me, I hope." Spectre took the Ingram and looked it over. The gun was well oiled and had a nice heft. "Sure. No flak jacket?" "Sorry." Spectre had hoped the jacket might help if the astronomer tried to tear out his heart. Just his luck. It was an item Gruber normally had around. "What about bullets?" "Right here," Gruber said, handing him an unopened box. "Why do you need a gun? I mean, being an ace and all, it just seems, unnecessary." Spectre noticed that Gruber was careful not to meet his eyes. He grabbed the fat man by the ears and pulled him close. Gruber tried to gouge Spectre's eyes with one hand and pulled a .22 automatic with the other. Spectre took hold of Gruber's gun hand and pointed it at the fence's stomach. There were two shots, both into Gruber's abdomen. Spectre knocked the gun away. He knew that Gruber would be a long time dying from the gunshot wounds. Spectre pulled Gruber's head around, forcing their eyes close. "No," said Gruber, shutting his eyes. Spectre punched Gruber in the throat, knocking him to the floor. He straddled the fat man and pinned his arms. "Don't kill me, please. No." "You're dead already." Spectre grabbed Gruber's eyelids and pulled them up. Gruber screamed, but it was too late. Their eyes locked. Spectre was the only person who had drawn the Black Queen and lived to tell about it. Unfortunately, the memory of his death was always there. He turned it loose on Gruber, projecting his agony into the man's body, convincing him that he was dying. Gruber's pudgy flesh believed. His eyes rolled up into his head, and he gasped. Spectre felt him turn to dead weight and let go. He looked at the desktop. Gruber had written one word on a notepad. "Stamps." He shrugged and turned away. Spectre put on the holster and slid the Ingram into it. If he ran into the astronomer, it might help. Then again, it might not.
He closed and locked the cage door, donned his mask, and left through the back.
Stupid! How much more of an idiot could I have been? Jack thought as he fought his way downtown through the throngs. His anger with himself still burned savagely. He scanned what he could see of 8th Avenue ahead of him. Where was the girl with the man wearing the purple suit and the dapper fedora? He hadn't called Cordelia's mother yet. Elouette would just have to wait, impatient or not. Jack had made the one phone call he thought might do some good. If Vagabond and her animals could just sight his niece, he'd take care of the rest. His tongue felt rough, sliding across teeth that were slightly more profuse, sharper, and longer than were normal. He tried to damp the anger. Time enough for that later. Control. Obviously, he had some now. At first, upon exiting the Port Authority, he'd searched at random, fighting his way first one direction through the crowds, then another. Then the human level of his mind started to calm the urgent reptile brain. Set up a grid. Don't repeat a line of search. Try downtown. Consider Fortunato a lead. He didn't know that the guy he supposed was a pimp was one of Fortunato's freelance talent scouts. In fact, he didn't know if the man even used that kind of scavenging talent, but it was worth a try. The man with Cordelia would find it easier to fall in with the flow of the crowds down toward Jokertown. 8th was less crowded right now than the other avenues. Eventually, Jack would have to worry about a good crosstown route, but for now he went on his hunch. It paid off. He came up to the intersection of 38th Street. Suddenly he saw, across the street, a familiar fedora bobbing a bit as though the wearer were looking about himself confusedly. He also saw the back of a head, a quick glimpse of a fall of shining black hair. The fedora moved toward the black hair. The young woman with the black hair moved farther away. She was running. Fedora pursued. Jack, staring after them, started off the curb. A hand grabbed his shoulder, roughly tugging him back. A honking yellow cab nearly took off his toes and latent snout.
"Watch it, bub," said a husky joker standing beside him. "Cabbies don't give a shit. Not today, not never."
By now the intersection was full of traffic. The last cabs to make it through had done so. Now there were vehicles lined up in either direction. No one seemed worried about automatic $25 tickets for gridlocking.
"Never a cop when you need one," somebody said.
Jack made it across the intersection like a good broken field runner. The Jets would be proud, he thought irrelevantly. This season they could use him. On the other side of 38th, he realized that neither the fedora nor Cordelia was in sight.
Damn it.
Sooner or later, he thought, striking downtown again. He looked around for one of Vagabond's birds, a cat, a squirrel, anything. Never a pigeon when you need one.
Having chosen her clothing from the collection of tattered and dirty mismatched coats, pants, and shirts she kept at Jack's, Vagabond jammed a Greek fisherman's cap on her stringy hair and left the cats behind as she made her way up to ground level through the tunnels that bypassed Jack's home. Agile from years of moving through the underground, she used the eyes of the rats who lived in the tunnels to show her the path. The floor-level view she gained from their perspective was enough to avoid most obstacles. She had spent days underground without using her own eyes. It was best to remove herself as much as possible from contact with the mass of people who crawled on the surface as her creatures crawled in their tunnels and burrows. Vagabond grasped the rungs of a ladder to the world above her and climbed. Shifting the manhole cover slightly upward, she looked around and saw only a sleeping derelict in the alley. She climbed out, replaced the cover, and limped toward the crowds at the mouth of the alley. Long ago, she had found the most direct route to Rosemary Muldoon's office in the district attorney's complex. Today, though, the streets were crowded with revelers. Many wore grotesque masks. Some were in full costume. Vagabond felt anger at these normal people. The virus that had given her a means of survival had also removed her from this human world. Sometimes she regretted it. Most of the time, she did not. It took no effort to curse the crowd and clear a path to the Justice Center. Somebody whistled, appreciative by the sound of it. She didn't glance around. It wouldn't be at her. Before the security guard noticed her, Bagabond joined a crowd of people waiting for the elevator. Keeping the crowd of three-piece suits between her and the guard, she walked with lowered head and sidelong glances to the stairs. It took several minutes to walk up to the 8th floor, but she hated the elevator. Instead of the usual receptionist, who knew that she was an old client of Rosemary's from her days with social services, the front desk was manned by a handsome, black-haired man in a brown suit. He was having trouble with the phone as she walked up. "Damn, lost another one. Whoever created hold buttons should be shot, don't you agree?" He spoke without looking up from the phone console whose buttons he was punching, even though I know that's no attitude for a lawyer. He finally looked up and his face registered surprise for just a moment. "Hello? What can I do for you?" He smiled at the bag lady. "Do you want this for? This is the DA's office. What are you looking for?"
"Rosemary."
Bagabond kept her head down and her voice weak and rough.
"Rosemary? I'm new here, but the only Rosemary here, I think, is Rosemary Muldoon. She's an assistant district attorney."
He turned to look dubiously down at the phone console.
"Well, I could try to buzz her, but..."
"Rosemary." The derelict's voice was stronger and angry. When he looked up again, he met, for a mere second, a pair of sharp and clear black eyes.
"I'll do my best."
The phone rang.
"Paul Goldberg, District Attorney's Office, may I help you?"
Bagabond started toward a door behind Goldberg, but it opened as she reached for the knob. The woman behind the door was petite, about 3 inches shorter than Bagabond. The bag lady knew that because they had once been obliged to exchange clothes. Rosemary's eyes varied from dark brown to hazel, depending on her mood. Today, they were dark and intense.
"Hello there, good to see you. Go right in, I'll be back in a moment."
Rosemary Muldoon held the door for the bag lady. Before she entered the office, Bagabond looked back at the receptionist's desk. Rosemary nodded.
"Paul, call that temporary service again. Tell them if someone doesn't show up in 15 minutes, we're calling another service. This is ridiculous." "Yes, Ms. Muldoon, I hope I didn't offend your client."
He smiled apologetically at the bag lady, who shook her head once, sharply.
"My friend, Paul," Rosemary said. "Hold my calls, will you, please?"
The man behind the desk sighed and nodded.
"Of course, Ms. Muldoon. I look forward to seeing you again, miss," he said to Bagabond.
He was already reaching for a ringing phone as Bagabond stared at him again, then turned and limped into Rosemary's office.
"Donis is on vacation and things are a mess."
Rosemary shut the door and walked over to the walnut desk.
"Here we are, understaffed, and our newest addition has to answer phones instead of working on the caseload."
"He's decorative, though." Rosemary perched on the side of her desk. "They offered me new carpet to replace this ghastly green shag. I took another staff attorney instead."
"Good choice."
Bagabond sat down on the edge of an old straight chair. She took off her hat and brushed the hair out of her face.
"How's Jack?"
Rosemary reached out and took the cap from Bagabond. Putting it on, she looked inquiringly at Bagabond, who shook her head.
"Doesn't go with a tweed."
Bagabond sat back carefully, as if worried the chair would collapse.
"Okay, I guess. We're not talking all that much right now. I just got a call from him before I came over. He's out hunting a niece who ran away to New York City."
Rosemary raised an eyebrow.
"Her name is Cordelia Chasen, 16, country girl from Louisiana. Jack says she's real pretty. Tall, slender, black hair, dark brown eyes. That's all he told me. He sounded pretty upset."
"I'll put the word out in the station houses," said Rosemary. "That much I can do. Too many kids run away to the city." She took a fountain pen out of the desk set by her hip. Bagabond nodded her appreciation.
"How's life off the street?"
"Who says I'm off the street? With this job, I never leave." Rosemary sighed and continued to play with the fountain pen. It was obvious she had other things on her mind.
"Things are getting worse with the family.
The butcher, remember Don Federico, is killing anyone who threatens his authority. It's no way to run the Gambioni family. We're no longer completely in control in Joker Town. Someone's setting the Jokers against us, the family. They're just being used, of course."
"Their Jokers are always getting used,"
Either they're the great downtrodden minority of this century, or else they're a plague to be eradicated. Bagamon fixed her with wide black eyes. Rosemary continued, They get something when they pay protection to the Gambionis. That's one tradition that even the butcher doesn't dare abandon. She gestured with a pen. I keep thinking that if my father had just had a son to take over the Gambionis, this wouldn't be happening. Maybe that SOB butcher will have a nice accident. Slip in the bathtub or something. He always was bad news. Bagamon smiled humorlessly up at Rosemary. Even our brief acquaintance, I can't say that he made a good impression. If I hear anything, I'll let you know. I usually avoid Jokertown, but the rats like it down there. Lots of food. I don't want details, please. Rosemary shivered. You want to know what else is making my life interesting? First thing I hear this morning is that there's some valuable notebooks on the street. I don't even know whose they are, but the egrets want them. If the egrets want them, so do I. You really do hear the strangest things, so if you find out anything about this, I would appreciate it. Rosemary wouldn't meet Bagabond's dark gaze. I feel as if I'm using you, Suzanne. But you know things no one else does. Thanks. I have a lot of eyes and ears. Bagabond looked out the window behind Rosemary's shoulder. You are a friend. I only have one other, human. I want to help. I wish Jack wasn't such an idiot, Rosemary said. What is wrong with that boy? She shook her head in sympathy. Have you thought of maybe looking elsewhere? Maybe at the mission? Bagabond combed her hair back across her face with her fingers and jammed the cap down on her head. She stood up and spread the ratty paisley skirt she wore over a pair of chinos. Or perhaps the singles bars. I could start a new fashion trend. I'm sorry. Rosemary slid off the desk and touched Bagabond's shoulder. Bagabond swung away from her hand. I've been alone for years. I'll survive. Besides, the cats would be happier. Bagabond showed her teeth, white and sharp. I'll be in touch. Rosemary opened the door and walked with her to the front desk. I've got court in 20 minutes. Just call me if you need anything, dear. The stooped and limping bag lady nodded her lowered head and walked away. As she passed the receptionist area, Goldberg looked up. Hope to see you again soon. Have a nice day. As he said the last words, the bag lady turned her head to stare at him. Yeah, I don't believe I said that either. He grinned and shrugged an apology, and the phone rang again. Bye. Making her way slowly down the stairs, Bagabond wondered if Jack had found Cordelia yet. Missing girls, missing notebooks, everyone was looking for something. She wasn't. It was the advantage of having nothing to lose.
The Jokers started all looking alike. So did the normals dressed and made up as Jokers. Jack blinked confusedly. Trying to survey all the faces he was encountering was akin to scanning more than about 6 rows of book spines in the Strand. After a while, the colors, the sizes, the titles all began to look the same. He saw black hair, never the right black hair. He saw fedoras, panamas, snap brims. Nothing was exactly right. At the corner of West 10th, he nearly collided with a kid heading east. Watch it, faggot, the young man said. Jack stared at him in surprise. You can't fool me, said the kid. Don't even try. Jack started to step around him, since it was obvious the kid wasn't going to move. Punk, he thought. Real street punk, not costume punk with mohawk and makeup. Shorter than Jack, the kid was as skinny as a ferret. Face hollowed, eyes the color of rainwater. There was a tight, spring-loaded look about him. Just watch it, he said again. As Jack moved past, he was jostled by a passerby. Recovering his balance, he brushed the kid's elbow with his hand. The young man recoiled, his hands coming up in what looked to Jack like a martial arts stance. Don't touch me, fairy, said the kid. They stared at each other for several seconds. Then Jack nodded, stepped back, and turned to go. He didn't look back, but had the feeling that the kid was staring after him with those clear, mean, psychopathically intense eyes.
The Crystal Palace smelled like any other bar in the morning, like stale smoke and spilled beer and disinfectant. Fortunato found Chrysalis in a dark corner of the club, where her transparent skin made her nearly invisible. He and Brennan sat down.